The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Very good morning to you. Welcome along this Tuesday morning to OTB AM. We're here with you every morning from 7:30 until 9:30. Kickstarting your day with all the sports news that you need to know and some that you don't. If you want to get in touch with us this morning, you can use the hashtag OTBAM. Johnny Ward is here. How are you?
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Johnny was scrapping on Twitter last night about the Unite the Union Champions Cup, but there was a much bigger scrap happening at around the same time. Raheem Sterling and Joe Gomez were at it, Johnny.
I don't know, were they at it that late? Like 9, 10 o'clock last night?
I think it was it? Well, he almost been training yesterday.
Yeah. This isn't actually in the paper, so it obviously happened quite late, but Gomez and Sterling clashed at the England training session, and England coach Gareth Southgate reportedly said, "We've taken the decision to not consider Raheem for the match against Montenegro on Thursday. One of the great challenges and strengths for us is that we've been able to separate club rivalries from the national team. Unfortunately, the emotions of yesterday's game were still raw." So they've obviously come down on the side that Sterling was wrong anyway. And it was
Gomez is available for selection. Let's make it so they've picked their star player and he ain't going to play this week.
It's interesting because the game was it was a fairly tense occasion on Sunday. I think Manchester City are kind of realizing now that they do have problems, and I think Guardiola's behaving in a manner almost to mask that. They're not defending very well for one thing, and this is obviously the game on Sunday.
Just showing some pictures here for those of you listening on Goal Out.
Yeah, and
what happened was Sterling, Gomez had the ball. Sterling wanted it. There'd been a free kick or a throw-in given. Sterling comes around him and tries to get at him, and Gomez pushes him away. And at that point, Sterling is enraged.
Sterling,
get hands off me.
Did react a bit strangely in the whole thing, but it seems a bit drastic, to be fair.
Tale of the tape. Who's the tallest?
Who's the tallest?
Yeah. What's the difference in size?
Of the two boys.
6'2"
and
5'7".
Yeah. It's pretty...
I'm not sure. Maybe the YouTubers would be allowed to get away with this, but Hearn father and son would feel a little bit shy about promoting a 5'7" guy against a 6'2" player.
I think Gareth Southgate knows England are going to win the game as well.
That helps. No. I mean, look, Sterling is their best player by a mile. I want to stick up the Raheem Sterling statement. This looks like an Instagram story, is it? Yeah, or a screen grab from Instagram. First and foremost, everyone knows what the game means to me. Everyone knows that I am not that way inclined. And more to the point, both Joe and I have had words and figured things out and moved on. We're in a sport where emotions run high, and I'm man enough to admit when emotions got the better of me, we move. This is why we play this sport, because of our love for it. Me and @JoeGomez5 are good. We both understand it was a 5-10 second thing. It's done. We move forward and not make this bigger than it is. Let's get focus on our game on Thursday. Love heart.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm guilty of this myself, but they should really, footballers and sports people should consult people just when they're putting out such a meaningful tweet. Just get your grammar right and focus.
No.
Be true to
yourself.
Warts and all.
Be true to yourself, I think.
Be true to yourself.
Oh, come on. If that came out in a report of an incident between myself and Joe Gomez, no, that's who he is. That's exactly right. I would think that if you PR that to the max, it goes through...
It's not even PR, just text from me.
Camel's a horse designed by committee, buddy.
Run your grammar eyes over this,
Why? That's how he speaks.
Let's get focus. I mean, he surely didn't mean that. That's a typo.
Let's get focus.
Yeah, I don't think he did.
Witnesses, which of now there's
emerged.
Exactly. I mean, just everybody's like straight onto WhatsApp to their agents going, "Oh, mate, you're not going to believe it." And like, well, I would, because it's just all over the paper.
It was a magnanimous message by him, though, to be fair.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I like Sterling.
Witnesses say they heard Sterling ask the Liverpool defender whether he was still the big man. Which isn't a great question, because he still is the big man. Certainly. He's 6'2", and he ain't changing anytime soon, Raheem. Yeah. That's a big difference in height. We're just looking at the photograph of him here. Now, I would say fair play to Raheem Sterling. It's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the dog. There's a lot of fight in Raheem Sterling.
Yeah.
He's brave. He's taking on 6'2".
Is it reflective of the fact that Man City are in the shit?
Well, certainly they were at the weekend.
That might be the bigger issue here. That they're getting a bit frustrated that the title is somewhat running away from them at this stage, and a team with Dejan Lovren in it, they still are comfortably beaten. It's pretty worrying.
All of the players apparently agreed that this was the right way to deal with the issue.
Mm. Well, they obviously think Sterling's kind of overstepped the mark, but in fairness, his message is quite magnanimous, and I'm sure we'll all forget about it in no space of time at all.
But Johnny, that's not how this works. We
have to talk about it.
Come on, we're live on the radio/internet right
next
now.
Next 2 hours.
Yeah, come on. What's your hot take on Raheem Sterling?
Yeah, well, he won't be playing in the next England game against Montenegro, so I think we'll leave it to Gareth Southgate.
If it was a big game, do you think he would have played?
I think he would have had.
They would have found a different way
decision
to
make. Yeah. It's very easy to
I see the chief football writers have all immediately pronounced on this, and Twitter helpfully puts them all together. Ollie Holt making the point that it looks like he is in charge. Rob Harris is making the point that getting out early, making a public statement from Southgate, kills all the rumours. Certainly, it doesn't kill the rumours, but it controls the narrative as best you can. Mm. And Sterling now has come out and said it, so they probably will be able to move on.
Didn't get in the papers as well, by the looks of it, which...
imagine what tomorrow's going to be like.
Which is a help.
You remember when Chelsea were at their peak and the other teams, the Man United team was good and Liverpool had Stevie G. The stories were that the Chelsea players would sit together, the Man United players would sit together and the Liverpool players would sit together and never would they mix at England
camp.
And maybe that was one of those reasons why that golden generation never performed.
When I was managing the under-16s at home, I used to always put, like, when you had two players in some sort of an exercise together, I'd always put two players that were from different parts of the parish that wouldn't know each other, because I think that's important. That, in a wider sense, I suppose, you room people together, unless you want to do the Roy Keane and Dennis Irwin, you room people together to get them to know each other, because there are cliques and squads. And I remember... Gerard spoke about that and it seemed quite profound. It was that there were a lot of different... You don't get the feeling in the Ireland squads necessarily anyway. They seem to be a lot more together than that. But yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about Ireland a little bit later on. The notion, our debate today is the notion that Ireland don't have the footballers. We're just not good enough to be able to keep the ball, pass the ball, control the ball and apply ourselves to a possession-based game. Let's face it. All of the managers we've ever had, with the exception of Brian Kerr for that brief period of time, would have said this publicly, largely, all the way back to Jack. Like, it seems not, I mean, you know, they're not as good as England, are they? Even though that was the best team we ever had. Trapp, very clearly, very pronounced. This isn't it. Maybe Mick McCarthy the first time around. But this time around, Mick McCarthy's basically like, look, I don't know if we're good enough here, you know. Mm. I mean, we're not going to be... fannied about with the ball at the back.
Don't have long enough to inculcate a change in system, because Mick McCarthy had, what, 6 meaningful games in this tournament and decided, like, I think Martin O'Neill decided that his remit was to get us qualified and the simplest thing to do was to not play football and to try to win games. And I'm not sure they necessarily believe our players are that bad, because if we watched a good bit of the Sheffield United game here on Saturday, where they more or less outplayed Tottenham for much of the game, they didn't look like players that play for Ireland. And Conor Hourihan does stuff for Villa, albeit he's not necessarily playing at the moment. But Conor Hourihan is able to play. But I think they consider it a risk, because it's so long now that Ireland teams don't really play football. And I think Jack probably has a good bit to answer for here, because Jack had players that were able to play. Jack had very good players.
Oh, amazing players who were definitely able to play.
It's interesting that Stephen Kenny, in Eamon Dunphy's podcast, I remember he interviewed him probably about a year ago, maybe last year, and he said, I wouldn't go to Ireland games back then. I just hated the way we played. And you might be seen as a kind of a football snob, but Jack achieved results. But maybe as a nation, the way we celebrate Italia 90 and, you know, the game against Egypt, which was... You know, we should have been done for war crimes, really. It was that bad. It was like horrible, horrible stuff. It was, and even other games that weren't as memorably bad were awful. But we seem to think that was fine. And as a football nation, we seem to really join in the party, while maybe not looking at the deeper question. When eventually Jack's scenes were found out quite badly in the end, that we were we were being left behind by teams that could pass the ball.
Yeah, I think there's stuff going on about the party that, like, bear in mind, we're coming out of the 80s, one of the grimmest periods in Irish life since the 50s. So if Absolutely. There's a party on,
oh, yeah,
and people want
yeah.
a party, I don't have too many problems with that. It's what the footballing...
Yeah.
It's what it does for our football culture.
Yeah, I was obviously too young to really, like, remember what was going on in the media then, but I don't know if people... had reservations about the way we played. I think, in fairness,
well, in fairness, don't be threw his pen across the studio. That's
yeah,
at the how bad we were playing, and that was that part of the narrative.
Yeah, I think in fairness to Mick though, in Mick's first reign, we didn't play bad football. In fairness, we weren't the worst.
Let's come back to this a little bit later on. Yeah. We had Roy Keane.
We did.
Who was passing the ball more than anybody else in world football at the time. Here's what's coming up on the show. That debate is coming your way a little bit later on. Phil's going to join us for that. Going to talk Irish football around about 20 past 8. Stephen Poacher is going to join us at 5 past 8, the end of his time. Carlo is upon us. He was announced it in the last couple of days. Sports pages are next. In the next hour then, Manchester United and Busby. Daniel Harris has been involved in making a new documentary about Matt Busby. We'll talk to him about that. And then I'm Angry is our new slot at 9:05. Phil is angry that Irish footballers can't get the credit they deserve.
Oh, is this contrived anger then? Is it actual anger, or we just have to be angry about something?
No, you don't have to be. Phil's pretty angry. Yeah.
Is Phil angry,
every
morning from Monday to Friday on OTB AM?
No, just once a week.
Once a week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we can all be angry once a week.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Maybe you can come in some Tuesday morning at 9:05 and you can be.
Phil's fuming, I've just been told. Absolutely fuming. Banging down the door to get in. I thought Phil was quite a placid, nice,
and so
know,
imagine
likeable
how,
bloke.
Imagine how upset he must be about this.
Raging.
For him to want to be raging publicly.
It's a good debate, though. It's a very good debate, and it's one that is very, very easy to go either side of, I think. Because we're not technically amazing, but we could be better.
Yeah. Here's the sports pages. OTB AM. It's 7:43 a.m. this morning, and here are your morning sports pages. The front cover of the Irish Examiner is a picture of Stuart Lancaster with 6 tackle bags, unwanted baggage. Lancaster won't carry can for Ireland failure. And then where in the world, home is where the heart is for globe-trotting O'Sullivan. And they also have an interview with Gareth Fitzgerald, the ex-Munster CEO. He's talking about how they had planned to make Jacques Nienaber the next head coach, but Razzy Rasmus obviously wants them to be part of his coaching ticket.
Yeah, this is the Sun. I found this a fairly strange editorial line. I won't turn my back on Ireland. Club role not in McCarthy's plan. As if there were any chance of Mick McCarthy abandoning Ireland. Like, I would have thought it was a billion to one. Although maybe they felt the question needed to be asked. Neil O'Riordan with the story. This obviously follows Mick O'Neill's move to Stoke, which, really is a very, very different scenario. Obviously has had no experience in managing in English football. Connolly sidelined and boss Unai told to get a grip. He's been warned by Arsene bosses. Results are not good enough. And Arteta ideal for City, claims Vin, and that is Vincent Kompany. He believes he's the natural successor to Pep Guardiola.
That's it. So that he won't take the Arsenal job, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, wait, don't take it. We want you. We want to have the option, but we're not going to give you the job right now because obviously we've got a manager who's pretty good. The back page of the Irish Independent this morning. Connolly blow is teen star ruled out of Danish date. This is the news, obviously, that came through last night, that Aaron Connolly is out of Ireland's Euro 2020 decider with Denmark on Monday. Damages growing came off at halftime in the game against Manchester United at the weekend. Pep won't face reaction. Won't face action for reaction. I can't understand this. Why is he not facing any... Why is he not facing any ban or... Can you just go out and, like, aggressively shake the hand of somebody going, yes, you're great.
Yeah.
No, you can't.
I was at the PFAI Awards the other night and I was relegated to the dregs table, the referees, you know. So we were with Neil Doyle, Paul McLaughlin and a few other lads and great night with them. But, you know, it was brought to the fore by, I think there was a Gaelic Games referee who was at the Connacht Leinster game on Friday night and he tweeted that there was some guy kind of abusing the referee and basically he was told in no uncertain terms, if you want to do that, get out. This is not a place to be abusing the referees. And
by the crowd?
It was by...
Or a steward?
I think it was a steward, but the crowd basically kind of applauded. That's what I recall from the tweet. And I was trying to reconcile that if you were, this was in the sports ground, if you were up in Eamon DC Park, what the reaction would be like. Because it's completely wrong what referees have to put up with. And the abuse that they get, and what the sneering kind of disdain from Guardiola on Sunday from guys that are trying to do their job. And bear in mind, these were decisions that weren't even clear-cut, not, if that even matters. And we have to get to a situation where referees need to be encouraged. When do referees change their mind before VAR came in? Maybe one in a million. It never happens. So this abusing of referees undermines them. It makes it less attractive. And I'd love to see any of these footballers or managers be better referees than the ones that are there. Like, I think the Premier League referees are absolutely outstanding. I think VAR has kind of undermined their role. I think in the League of Ireland we have very good referees as well. They need to be encouraged. And I think we need in football to really start clamping down on this nonsense, because it's not fair. I think abusive language to a referee should be a straight red card. I really do believe that. We should get to a situation where there's respect for what they do, because you get away with far too much. And it still astounds me. I know the players will argue back that there, a lot of the referees are quite like arrogant. They won't explain themselves. And I think I was talking to Paul McLaughlin about this at the weekend, who was in the running for the Premier Division Referee of the Year, which absolutely ludicrously went to Michelle O'Neill, who I don't think she's even refereed a game in the Premier Division. She seemed to get it in a kind of a symbolic gesture. But he was saying that, you know, you do talk to them, but the referees who kind of are like standoffish and they make decisions and they're kind of, they look down on you, they don't explain themselves. I can see why that would make players kind of disgruntled, and would really, if you're a player who's angry, that'll really make your blood boil. But we have to get to a situation in football where referees are treated with the respect they deserve, because it's putting...
What's going to make that happen?
Rule change, I think. It has to happen. Like, but Guardiola should definitely guess.
Biggest match in the world at the weekend.
And no. What,
Guardiola storms over, shaking hands with everybody angrily, and then holds the hand just that little bit longer.
What message is that?
I mean, they should have timed his normal post-match hand after a win with the referee and gone, oh, that's like a second and a half. That seems to be 3.5 seconds. You're saying there's no difference here, Pep.
Yeah.
Why is it so much longer?
Absolutely. And
are you trying to intimidate him for the next time? Yes, you are.
Even the narrative as well, that I think Pat Fenlon said in the cup final recently, where we don't want to see the referee, that means he's having a good game. I think we kind of need to get around that as well. We have to recognise when referees make good decisions that are really, really difficult at the time, and when assistant referees get the right call on a dodgy offside, we should give them praise, because these are really difficult decisions when they get them right, especially under unbelievable pressure. Like, penalty takers, effectively, a penalty taker should not miss. He should be good enough at that level to hit the top corner. They don't, because of pressure, and referees are under pressure as well. We need to give them kudos when they make the right call. And, you know, I completely agree with you. I think Guardiola deserved to be sanctioned for that.
Yeah, okay. And then they also have the back page there. Is O'Driscoll's remarks came as a surprise to Lancaster. Leinster senior coach Stuart Lancaster was surprised by Brian O'Driscoll and Easton Asewa's suggestion that some of the Ireland players may become muddled in their thinking on the back of Leinster's expansive style of play. So I don't think that they were suggesting they became muddled in their thinking. I would suggest that they took stuff, what O'Driscoll and Asewa were saying, as far as I could understand it, was Stuart Lancaster arrived in, Leinster started to play really well. The Leinster players brought this to the Ireland setup. Ireland used it, played really well. And then the Irish coaching ticket made a decision to go back to what they were doing previously and not to continue with what they'd been doing at Leinster. So it's not that the players became muddled in their thinking, it's that the management at Ireland, senior international level, decided, oh yeah, well, let's have a little bit of this now, let's see how that's going. Oh, that's working really well for us, let's stop doing it. Is essentially what I think Issa was suggesting happened, that there was a conscious decision to go back to a different game plan.
Mm. Yeah, would the Irish management have any issue with kind of what he said, the incoming Irish management?
With what, who's
Lancaster, would they be like,
no, I don't think so.
Should he be getting involved, or is it like...
Well, it's his job to answer questions at a press conference. Mm. So he's there, he's like, and his name has come up, and Leinster, like, this is what Leo Cullen said too, so I don't think so. I mean, they all work together.
Seems a deeply impressive guy.
Yeah, and so I would say he should be getting as involved as possible.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the...
The Times London has an interesting one, not unrelated to our referee debate. Sort out VAR car crash or scrap it now. Clubs to demand action from referees chief. we were obviously here Saturday, the Sheffield United game. Actually met Inda Stevens. He was at the awards that night and he was kind of having a laugh about it. He was like, well, what do you do? But it was quite harsh for Inda Stevens because he was obviously involved in a bit of a mix-up for the Tottenham goal. And then he redeemed himself. Redeeming is kind of stupid because things happen in games and so on. It's not like, oh, I have to right or wrong here by creating a goal.
But he did.
He thought he had. And then 3 minutes, 40 seconds later, they went back for not only a very marginal offside call, which you could kind of argue, well, he was offside, but it was a different phase of play, in effect. You know, Tottenham had cleared the ball. And when they did equalise Sheffield United very shortly afterwards, it went to VAR. And I was kind of saying to Dan and Nathan, I was like, I kind of hope this is disallowed because this will be so ludicrous and so ridiculously offensive to what Sheffield United have done in the second half that it might actually compel people to say this is enough of this rubbish. Because I've gone off VAR, I have to say. I put up a poll on Twitter and this means that, you know, this is all you need.
Definitive, really. Yeah.
85-15 people, it's making me enjoy the game less. I saw another poll subsequently that people are basically turning against it. And the Times article is basically a group of Premier League chiefs will demand to know the car crash that is VAR, raise the possibility of scrapping the technology mid-season, which would be interesting. Because obviously we had plenty of content. But it is making, it's just making the game less kind of spontaneous and ad hoc in terms of the enjoyment. And I think Phil Egan, the very angry Phil Egan before he got angry, has made the point that he's kind of, you know, you see goals now and you don't really want to celebrate lest you look a fool a minute later. And wasn't Nathan was saying when Lallana scored against Man United, he was commentating on the game and he didn't really want to go over the top in the celebration because he's like, I think he might be offside there. This is a VAR. So I think the negatives are outweighing the positives.
Yeah, I wonder, is that just teething problems and everything's fine in 6 months' time? Or is this now something, it's a different game and we all have to...
Possibly. To be honest, if they use it for goal line technology, if they use goal line technology, I'd be fine in terms of technology. The rest, I'm not really sure we need. Marginal offside calls, nobody dies.
Yeah. All right. Nadine Coyle is going to be in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out Here, alongside James Haskell, rugby player, Ian Wright, Caitlyn Jenner. Is this the most sporting...
Did Kevin Kilbane, like, did he get the call for that, or was it just
he's
got inferior dancing on ice?
Exactly, you got to work your way up in the
celebrity
stratosphere. Yeah,
is that, you think, his grand plan?
I mean, why not? Like, come on, you get paid loads of money to do this, don't you?
Problem is, then people will start.
Andrew Maxwell's in it as well.
Oh. People will start knowing Kevin for his celebrity appearances rather than his
football
many hundreds of appearances in the football pitch and his football analysis.
The Irish Daily Mail this morning is Connolly KO. So Aaron Connolly's out. Ireland blow as Tien is ruled out of Danish clash. Should Clifford be the one anointed to end number 13 curse for Kingdom? They don't really believe in curses and Kerry, but, you know, maybe they'll just give him the 15 jersey instead. And Lancaster chaos theory wasn't at fault in Japan. So
the mirror goes with no con job for Mick, I think, which was the big narrative, obviously, of the day. Connolly out of both games. Warner calls it quits. The Cardiff boss left and six hit Lilies put on United front in final cruise. There was a funny moment in that Linfield-Dundalk game. As you say, got a bit of heat on Twitter last night about the game, but the PA at the ground said he was announcing Chris Shields as the man of the match and he called it the Unite the Nation man of the match is... Oh, sorry, the Unite the Union man of the match. So it was a beautiful double on... Because the Linfield fans... what would have been at Oriel Park, though? They may not have been able to actually hear him because everything is pretty bad in that ground. But the Linfield fans were over in the corner. Very, very cold night by the border. They probably wanted something to give them cheer. And I dare say some of them had a bit of a laugh at that anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. The Telegraph Sport. I turned down the Lions. It's Warren Gatland in front of the London Eye. I turned down the All Blacks in favour of the Lions. I turned down the All Blacks is what the headline says.
Big news.
It's not really, though, is it? Because, like, he didn't actually turn down the All Blacks.
That's the headline, Ger.
He was asked if he was available. And he's like, no, I'm doing the Lions. You sure you know I'm doing the Lions?
Then he turned them down.
No, he didn't.
He turned down the chance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He turned out to be one of 40 people that they... literally, the All Blacks have identified 20 or 30 odd coaches who would potentially fit the bill as the next... Like, we all know there's a guy within the camp already who is almost nailed on to be getting it.
And Gatland sees that and knows that he hasn't coached back at home. And so therefore, and so he'd be putting himself forward to get rejected.
Clever cookie or Gatland.
He's a genius. And he's got a lot of buddies in the English media ahead of the Lions. I mean, in fairness, the Telegraph gets off on the Lions quite a lot.
You do like your share of rugby, your share of football. Do you find they're more interesting, engaging coaches? When you look at the Eddie Jones, obviously, as well, and Gatland and the spats that they have, and Joe Schmidt's a fairly intriguing character. Are they more interesting than your average football manager?
There's far fewer of them, so you're exposed to them more often. Mm. And Gatland is very forthcoming about the fact that he dislikes certain things, like the IRFU who stabbed him in the back, and he will say that. Like, he will say, they stabbed me in the back. And he'll name names, and and he'll bear grudges, and I like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I respect the fact that he uses that as motivation.
What's Andy Farrell going to be like? Is his accent as like ridiculously Wigan North England as Richard Cooper?
It's
hardcore,
pitch perfect.
Yeah,
it's So I think that
good press conferences.
Yeah, and I think that everybody's going to like and warm to that.
My cat.
I don't know that much about my cat, really. I don't think that, like, so we see nothing of that backroom team at the minute, so I wouldn't say we'll see too much of my cat, you know? Maybe he'll be up for some press conferences occasionally, one at the start, and then on match week, maybe he'll be up for stuff, but I'd be surprised.
More interesting than Joe Schmidt's?
With Joe Schmidt, it was always kind of what was how the manipulation of the message was being massaged through things.
Bringing out a book.
It's very interesting because he's going to have to talk about it.
It's 50 quid to appear at, with a copy of the book, I think, 50 quid to appear at the kind of promotional events. And would you get a free copy of the book as well? Maybe, obviously, you get to meet Joe, I suppose.
Right.
Because what's the name of No Ordinary Joe, I think? I think it's
the opposite.
Ordinary Joe. I thought it was an interesting title. It was like, could you have done something a bit more pizzazz, Ordinary Joe? Like, it's kind of, it's stating the message, but it's like, is it going to sell the book, Ordinary Joe? You're putting the word ordinary in the title of a book.
Yeah, but is it not, like, clear that he's not an ordinary Joe? So it's like, is it not false self-modesty?
I don't know.
Or is he telling us that actually he is just an ordinary guy with this one obsession in life?
It's hardly a great endorsement of his book, though, is it?
I mean, because the way it all fell apart so spectacularly, everybody wants to get in and see the 100 pages where he goes, we've just beaten the All Blacks, we're the number one team in the world, we're on top of the mountain, and I'm looking down going, well, I might have a nice house over there, and I'll see what's going on. How did they go from there to the car crash that was the World Cup?
Did the car crash, will that help his book sales?
I think so. I think
maybe
that, like,
it will. Well, Tainted Legacy.
Well, I think that everybody...
That would have been a good name.
Tainted Legacy.
Yeah.
Tainted in a book.
Don't think he would have gone for it, but...
give me some other titles then.
Let's get some names in.
Yeah, come on. What
good
have you got?
Names for Joe's book.
Do they all need to be puns on Joe?
I don't think Ordinary Joe is great.
Schmidt Happens?
Yeah, that was taken, I think.
It was. Ross and Carl Kelly, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure they would have gone for that.
I don't think so either.
But it was probably still better than Ordinary Joe. Maybe Ordinary Joe's a good name. I just don't think it would compel me to think that. I mean, you're kind of saying, like, you have two words in your book cover and one of them is ordinary. I mean...
But the whole point is you thought it was No Ordinary Joe, right?
I want to read the book. I mean, if you're telling me he's ordinary, like, and but he's just ordinary, 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 ordinary. And Joe is a fairly... I mean, it's a one-syllable name. There's not a lot going on there. Ordinary Joe. Like, I don't know. You would have done something different, I think.
The Guardian this morning. Their back page is an ad for Nike. There you go. Didn't mean to do that, sorry. the back page of their sports section is, everywhere I go, they shout Rooney at me. Everyone. Kieran Trippier in life at Atletico Madrid and why Gareth Southgate is perfect.
Why are they shouting
Rooney at Trippier? Because he's English. Mm. So Rooney's the only one who's... He's the shining beacon of Englishness in Madrid.
Mm.
There you go.
There we are.
Arsenal have Emery's back, but things need to improve. This seems like it's a headline from yesterday, but it is Tuesday the 12th of November at the back of the Guardian.
Yeah.
I thought that Emery story was out yesterday.
Difficult times for Unai. pretty insipid against Leicester. Things aren't great.
Right, you're done, are you? Okay, so...
Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, I have no more papers here. I only got three papers. I've been sidelined.
I'm no cloppy cat. Mick McCarthy won't be following Michael O'Neill's lead and double job his way back into a club management post.
I don't know. I would not have thought of that as a story. Mick has like literally had no time off effectively since he came into management. So I imagine he'll want to get back into management. It just seems to be his way of life. But like, was there really a chance of him being, you know, was there really a chance of a club taking him on at the moment? I wouldn't have thought so.
No, I don't think. Is his reputation very high in England at the minute?
Well, it's also he's getting on a bit, like, so he's enough to be doing with the Ireland situation. Mick O'Neill was a completely different scenario.
Matty Donnelly out for 6 months, has had surgery. And he will have surgery in a hospital in London today and faces up to 6 months out. It's a bad injury, said Matty Donnelly. Got the results of the scan last week. It's revealed that one of the tendons of the bone and the hamstring has, I think it's been torn. So I think I'll just get that. So no, not doing
the desperate tendons blow this time of the year, and make it difficult to be back in reasonable shape for the start of championship, but at least he has that time frame.
Yeah, so it says on page 46 it's continued, but I can't find it on page 46. So there you go. I lied to you. You'll have to wait and find out exactly. I think it's torn. Got the Irish news for you as well this morning. The Irish news is Donnelly injury, a blow for Red Hands, and McCarthy happy in the job he has. So
interesting there, Blues whitewashed. So Irish news would obviously have a different audience, not necessarily Linfield fans, I don't know about that or whatever, but they took on the fact that the Blues were whitewashed, rather than, I suppose, obviously Dundalk wearing white, but the headline kind of focuses in on how bad Linfield were. I don't know, maybe I'm making too much of this, but the optics were appalling in that game last night.
So your point very simply was that if you're a club from the north, you're looking at that and you're going, we're never going to be able to compete against the best teams in the south. Is that it?
Pretty much. In that, it is a kind of a turkeys voting for chicken scenario, in that, like, Linfield have resources up there. Linfield did very well in the Europa League this year. I think they got around £1 million from it. The prize money in the Irish League is absolutely dreadful. It's even worse than down here. But if there are doubts about the All-Ireland League, in that, what is the actual Kieran Lucid's idea? What is the actual TV company that's going to put forward this seven-figure sum? And where is the rest of the money going to come from? Now, Kieran Lucid will say, we can't really answer that until we actually get the vote and we can move forward, which is fine, but there is an element of trust there. So if there are Irish League clubs wavering, and clearly there are, and there are clubs in the South probably wavering as well, if you're an Irish League club in the North that can't compete with Linfield, and you watch Linfield with a nearly full-strength team, go to Dundalk, lose 6-0, could have been about 12-0. Dundalk were 4-0 up without actually creating a goal, because Linfield gifted them all of the four goals. It had echoes of the end of the Setanta Cup, where the Northern teams were so inferior. I'm not sure there would be Northern Ireland clubs would look at that. Like, why would we join this league? First of all, we have to take it on trust that the money is there. We're going to give up European places, I would imagine. And on the evidence of that, none of the Irish league clubs would be getting into the European places. Because Linfield were, and I am jumping the gun a bit, it was a two-off game, granted, it wasn't a Europa League tie. But at the same time, why were Linfield so bad?
Who knows?
Maybe the game at the weekend.
Maybe they don't care about this. Maybe they're not that enthused about this made-up trophy.
Good prize money for this as well in a league that doesn't have good prize money. They should be representing the Irish League in a game like that. Basically, they were missing one or two of their best players. Lavery was out. They were absolutely appallingly bad. They were so poor. 6-0, the optics are terrible.
You sat here one Friday afternoon and talked to us about a game that you'd been at Linfield where they played Carabag, and they were quite good.
They were excellent. Now, that game was a little bit misleading in that they hit them on the break and all that, but they were good that night. Windsor Park was rocking. Linfield are not as bad as they showed last night, but to me, and Daniel McDonald said, it probably did more harm than good for the AIL prospects. Emmett Malone more or less said something similar. I don't think the All-Ireland League is going to happen after this. I think the Northern clubs will definitely, the ones that were 50-50 won't vote for it after seeing Linfield getting beaten 6-0 by a Dundalk team that wasn't even out of second gear.
Yeah.
And that's, maybe I'm wrong on that, but looking at that game last night, you're looking at other League of Ireland clubs taking on, like Shamrock Rovers, St. Pat's against Linfield last night. Rovers would have hockeyed them as well. And Linfield are by far the biggest team in the North.
Yeah, but look, is there no possibility that Linfield just had a bad night? That something happened that maybe, I don't know.
Possibly. The optics are really bad, though. For we don't get to play them in proper games very often. And when we do, it shouldn't be 7-1 on aggregate. It shouldn't be 7-1 on aggregate. There were no issues with fitness. It's in the middle of the season. It's in the end of our season. It's not like a pre-season game. It should be a big deal. There's good prize money. David Healy gave it the respect it deserved with the teams he picked. And Linfield were like a pub team. They were like a First Division team last night from the League of Ireland. In fact, they wouldn't win the First Division. They wouldn't even get close to win the First Division playing like that.
Yeah. All right. The other big story from the last 24 hours was Stephen Hunt throwing his former international teammate Kevin Kilbane under the bus. The headline is, "Me and Kevin Kilbane have been in coppers more times since we retired than as footballers." He was doing a gig for Now TV and he was interviewed, and he ends up talking about Kilbane.
I think
it's
that's
hilarious.
A headline. Is that not obviously it's a reflection on the fact that you like a few pints when you're older, but it's like we were professional footballers and now that we've retired we can enjoy ourselves a bit more.
Yeah, in specific venues though. in specific places.
Yeah. Coppers has been taken on now. The Black Door looks like it's eaten into that hegemony or whatever you want to call it. It's Coppers may not be the big leader it once was. It's up for sale as well, isn't it?
They took it off the market last week.
They took it off the market.
Yeah.
Still, Dublin's nightclub scene is so small that you just see every Tom, Dick and Harry ends up there, I suppose, including Kevin and Stephen Hunt.
Every Kevin and Stephen and all the rest of the Ireland internationals. Right, 7 minutes past eight this morning. You're listening or watching us on OTBAM. You're probably watching us on YouTube, or if you're listening to us, maybe you're listening to us on the Go Loud app. If you don't know what that is yet, get onto the Play Store or wherever you get your Apple apps, the App Store, I believe it's called, and you can get Go Loud right there and you'll have OTB Sports Radio in your earbuds all day. We've got ex-Carlo coach, Stephen Poacher up next, talking about his decision to step away. Back after this. OTB AM. All right, a very good morning to you. If you just joined us, you're welcome along to OTB AM. I'm delighted to say that Stephen Poacher joins us now to talk to us about his tenure in Carlo and just generally get a pulse of where we are with GAA at the moment. Stephen, good morning to you. How you doing?
Well, lads, how's the form?
Good, thanks. Was it a difficult decision in the end to step away, or had you just kind of reached the end of your natural road with Carlo?
No, listen, it wasn't something that was thought about for a lot of months, lads. You know, it was a very difficult decision, and I travelled down on Saturday and got to chat with Turlock, you know, and it was an emotional enough conversation, you know, a lot of reflection, a lot of good memories. And, you know, listen, lads, to be honest with you, you know, my circumstances have changed recently, and, you know, the reasons are personal to myself. But look, you know, there's a whole number of little small variables, like my job has changed again. I'm now based in Newry teaching PE in St. Joseph's High School in Newry here, and I've done a lot of work after school with the teams as well, and that's obviously going to take up a lot of my time in January, February and March, unfortunately, which is the key months. And, you know, my oldest girl and I started school in Newry as well, and Marie used to be sort of the sole bearer of collecting them from school and leaving them to school, and now that whole role has changed as well. So just, lads, after travelling, you know, 250 miles three or four times a week, and, you know, it's three years now, well, possibly nearly four, because in 2016 I would have dipped in for about four or five sessions during the year that no one probably would have been aware of, that Turlock had just asked me to come down. So on and off for about 4 years now, getting up and down the road, and just got to the stage, lads, where it's just, as I said to the man, you know, it's just time to give a bit back to the family, maybe, you know, and try and seize a bit of time back, even for myself, even from a health perspective, lads. You know, you have to be 100% mentally and physically tuned in to make that journey and put that performance on in training and be really tuned in. I just felt it just wasn't going to be able to facilitate that energy, you know.
Did you have this conversation with yourself last year around about this time and decide to go back for one last year? Or was this the first year that you kind of really felt, okay, I need to start paring back a little bit?
Yeah, well, I think last year, you know, it's the girls are getting older, lads, you know, and, you know, they're very impressionable, the kids, you know, and when you're out of the house for 3 or 4 days and you leave the house at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to school and you don't return to 12 o'clock that night, and you don't see them, you know, it can pull in the heartstrings a little, you know, and I think the wife said to me last week, you know, we get a wee bit of time back for ourselves now, you know, and it is like it has to be a strong consideration. I don't think people understand, you know, the impact that your commitment has on the family, you know, and the likes of that. And look, it was probably last year, it was probably the first year that, you know, I probably felt a mental drain as much as anything. The journey was taking on me, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I know I might look still young, but I'm not getting any younger myself. And I just felt, look, you know, it's I'm back home in Newry now, working at home, and it's my job's on my doorstep, but I've gained a lot of time back. I'm doing a bit of training myself as well now and stuff like that. So even from a mental health perspective, like, you're in a better place of mind, you know, and I just felt that if I start making the journey again, it's going to be a very, very difficult one. And I needed lads to be true and to be honest to Turlick and the group, because that's all we've ever been. And we've been very tight and very close. And listen, Saturday was very emotional. When I drove back down the road on Saturday, like, I'm not going to tell you, I shed a tear, you know, because we shared some wonderful memories down there, you know.
Will you miss the intercounty setup, or will you miss the Carlow lads more? What's the, like, is there, I know they don't seem different, but it's definitely a different thing. The grind of the intercounty is something that definitely gets people down, but the specific group of people that you were working with.
No, listen, lads, it probably is unique. Carlow probably unique because of the point of view being that we probably maybe did things against the grain, you know. We didn't impose media bans. We didn't impose social media bans. We had fun. We had fun. We enjoyed ourselves. We let the players enjoy themselves, you know. And listen, lads, for me, and I said this the other day, for me, sport has to be a release in life, lads. You know, it has to be something that players enjoy. You know, you can't, like, we live in a society now where there's so much pressures on young people. There's pressures in employment. There's pressures in relationships. There's pressures financially, you know. And sport and football is our release. You know, sport and football should be a place, a sanctuary, to get away from that, where all your troubles go away, you know, where you have a bit of fun, you have a bit of enjoyment, you know. And I like to see players smile at things, and I like to see the fun. And but here, listen, be under no illusions, we worked really hard and we trained hard and you know, we did the graft, but you have to enjoy yourself, lads, you know. And people might point at Dublin and argue the fact that, yes, you know, that there's the enjoyment comes when five in a row, etc. And I understand that, like, but there's a lot of our counties that I don't feel are really, really maximising what they have, because maybe there's restrictions on them, or, you know, players are maybe feeling a little bit in prison. But, you know, you have to enjoy yourselves, because for me, lads, there's too many other things in life at the minute, you know. And players need that release, you know. They need that enjoyment. And I suppose that's what we had in Carlow. It was unique in that respect. Like, so we didn't probably feel the strain of the intercounty scene. Like, we enjoyed ourselves, you know. As Turlick said to me on Saturday, he says we probably changed the footballing landscape for the weaker counties, and we rattled a few cages. And he's right, like, you know, we probably did. And it was a fantastic experience for me, because Turlick gave me a very, very hands-on approach. And because we had such a small backroom team, I found myself doing an awful lot of coaching, an awful lot of video work, an awful lot of prep work, an awful lot of team talks, you know. And that's an experience you might not get in another setup, because backroom teams now tend to be bigger than the bloody Carlow panel. It's more probably miss the group, miss the players, you know. I got some humbling message that nearly brought me to tears. The wife says I need to catch myself on, says, and grow up, she says, you know. But it shows the bond that we had, the connection we had. And, you know, you're looking now and you look back and you've made some seriously really good friends for life. And I said to Turlick on Saturday, lads, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm a down man. I was involved in down for 10 years. I'm back involved again. You know, it's your own county, it's your own passion, you know, that's where your heart lies. But I never felt I would feel a passion and a love for another county like I did for Carlow. And, you know, something clicked and something worked, and yeah, I'll miss that. Yeah,
your point just about the players there, Stephen, being kind of I suppose snaffled in terms of the way that they can talk, and the way that Gaelic games has gone at intercounty level in that regard, Is that something you've spoken to people about, in, you know, the fact that the Dublin players at the All-Stars, like, more or less wouldn't talk, or even after winning five in a row said very little. They've virtually nothing to offer to the media all year round. This is the Dublin team. My worry for Gaelic football is that Gaelic football is in a fairly transformative place at the moment, where it faces an uncertain future, and yet you have managers and county boards, particularly managers, who won't let their players actually talk and promote the game year in, year out. And for me, were Carlow any better or worse for the fact that your players actually could talk their mind and could have a bit of fun? I would argue no.
Absolutely, lads. I totally agree with you. You know, and I remember the All-Stars a couple of years ago. And listen, I'm this is all due respect. Dublin are probably the best coach team that I've ever seen. You know, in my generation, they're the best coach team. There's no question about that. And
they're well media coached as well.
And yeah. Listen, they're coached in every aspect of the game. And, you know, and I'm sure they're really nice lads. And to be honest with you, I met Dean Rock and Kieran Kilkenny back in February at a talk night in Savile. And I got a real good insight into what they're really like, you know. And listen, two great lads. The crack was brilliant. You know, we shared some jokes. I remember, I'll tell a quick story, but Kilkenny, there was a bit of slagging about Carlow, and Kilkenny took the microphone and he says, I'll tell you a good one about Poacher. We were playing Carlow in the championship a few years ago, and we were 10 points up, and Poacher was squealing at the players, get back, get back. and I said Kilkenny, but you didn't realise that half of Carlow had Carlow back plus 22, so we needed to make sure that. But yeah, and then Rock took the microphone and says, sure, look, we're on the gargle all week because we're only playing Newsboys, you know. But listen, you've seen an insight to them that day that a lot of people wouldn't see, you know, and they are human, you know, and they're normal lads, and they're living a dream, as some of them have said on social media. Like, but it's really only when they retire that they come out and be vocal and speak and open their minds up. And listen, lads, the game needs character, it needs colour, you know. And people slag Jurgen Klopp, and I hate Liverpool. I'm going to be honest with you, I'm a Man United fan, I despise them, but I admire Klopp for what he does, and he goes against the grain, he goes against the norm. And I think last year in one of the games against Everton, I've never seen the like of it in my life. When they scored a goal in the last minute, he was on the field hugging his players in the middle of the field. You know, that's unheard of in this day and age and in modern day Premiership terms. Like, and Gaelic football needs characters, it needs colour. You know, you're sick listening to the same drivel all the time and the same robotic answers. And, you know, why don't people just be themselves? You know, people say to me, you're an extrovert, you're this, you're that. I'm not, I'm just being myself. You know, that's the personality that I am. I'm very outgoing. I've done 42 coaching workshops in 18 different counties over the last couple of years. I'm happy to spread the knowledge. I'm happy to share my experience. And I'm not an expert, but the greatest resource we have as coaches is each other, you know, and I've always said that. And I think it's important that we learn that from the game, you know, and we take that, because the game is in a very precarious situation, lads, you know, and with the rule changes. And I think we could be facing, you know, into an era where there's a little bit of uncertainty. We're into Tier 2 Championship talk. We're into marks and, you know, developing like a hybrid type of a game, you know. But listen, I'll take a great story from the other day when I was chatting to Paul Broderick the other day, and he was talking about what the last couple of years have done for him as an individual, you know, in his own career, you know, his own teaching career and the personal profile that it's raised with him within his own school and the community. And like his All-Star nomination, for example, like that was fantastic for him. And I remember a couple of times him saying to me in Turlick, is it okay to do this interview? Is it okay to do that interview? And I says, do them all, Paul. Do them all, because this is a short window. This is a great opportunity for you. Enjoy it. Live the dream, you know, enjoy yourself. And it's important, lads, because people have said to me about the media impact for the Tier 2 Championship, oh, it's not about media coverage. Of course it's about media coverage. Media is the most powerful tool that we have in society at the present moment in time, particularly social media. And if young people are seeing their teams playing against big teams, like, for example, the games Carlo had against Dublin and Monaghan live on Sky, Netwatch Cullen Park packed to the rafters for the Tyrone game, 8,500 people, 200, 300 Carlo kids in the pitch at half-time. It's a massive impact for everyone down the food chain. It promotes and pushes the game and shows young people that they want to play for their county and gives them heroes to look up for and role models, you know.
Yeah, so what do you think are the challenges facing the GAA at the moment? You mentioned the rule changes there and kind of drive by as well of the Tier 2. As somebody who understands exactly what that impact is going to be on the ground for Carlow, is Tier 2 a bad or a good thing?
I think it's an absolute utter disaster, lads, to be honest with you. And listen, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think every president wants to leave their mark, and Horan wanted to leave his mark, and his mark was the Tier 2 Championship, but he walks away now having achieved something and, you know, and caused a bit of a stir. And the bottom line for me, lads, is the financial irregularities within the counties. You know, I'm looking at Carlow in the last couple of years, and I have to be honest with you. You know, there's Turlough O'Brien for 5 years has soldiered for Carlow with no financial gain whatsoever. I don't even think the man claimed travel expenses, and that's the truth. You know, he done it because he's a proud, passionate Carlovian, but he also done it as well because the county is financially restricted. You know, at the end of the day, the Hurling is a very small county. You've Hurling, you've football. We had no GPS trackers, lads. Now, I know that might seem like for those people on the outside, might seem like a big thing. It's a massive thing, you know, to monitor workloads, to monitor, you know, training loads, etc. And it's huge. You know, it's absolutely huge. And there's teams in Tyrone, there's school teams in Tyrone that are using GPSs like school teams. You know, and an inter-county side, we couldn't literally afford them. Like, and, you know, that's what we were working with. Our hands were tied. You know, I did all the video work. We didn't have performance sports. I chopped the videos and dissected them myself. You know, it took 3-4 hours, maybe 5 hours of time. People don't see that on the outside. You know, they look in and they think it's an inter-county setup. We had a goalkeeping coach who was a volunteer from one of the local clubs. You know, there was no specialist goalkeeping coach. You know, and that's what we were restricted with. Turlough has asked Crow Park for help financially. There was one night Abbottstown was touted as being used for the Dublin-based players to do their strength conditioning to stop them having to travel back to Carlow. The lads went over to the gym. Everything was fantastic. 2 weeks later, went back to the gym, and Dublin GAA had cleared the gym out because it was their equipment. You know what I mean? You know, so these things are very, very challenging, like, for the smaller counties. Like, and for me, lads, Crow Park have got to step up and say, look, the gap is getting bigger, and it will get bigger. And the only reason it's getting bigger is because it's financial. You know, it's at the end, that is very, very easily solved. Start distributing the financial contributions in a more equal basis and give these smaller counties a chance. And listen, I'm not going to name, but I hooked up with about 4 or 5 different inter-county managers and coaches over the summer to pick their brains and share a coffee and because at the end of the day, as I said before, it's the greatest resource we have. And listening to some of those managers about the fundraising capabilities that they had, you know, talking about raising hundreds of thousands of pounds. And I'm sitting trawling around the local businesses in Cardiff last year trying to grab a couple of thousand pounds off some businesses as well to help us out, to help the county board out, to try and take us on one training night, on one night, overnight stay, you know, which was even hard to bargain for, you know. And it is, lads, a serious issue. And, you know, if you want to try and raise the standards on the field, you have to try and raise them off the field as well. And I think those issues are more important than dabbling with a rule change of a mark inside the 45, you know, which, let's be honest, like, it's going to cause absolute havoc at club level. You know, referees are now having to monitor sin bin times and, you know, marks and the likes of that. And, you know, it's unfair on the referees. You know, it really is, because I don't know how it's going to be policed. Like, underage level, what do they do? You know, you have a big man who catches the ball from the middle of the field from a kick out, turns, kicks it in the full forward, catches it, and there's two scores and not one single play, you know. And I don't know, it's I think we're going down the wrong line. I think we're looking at the wrong issues. I think
What are the right issues? Is it financial? Is it purely financial?
Absolutely. It's massive. It's absolutely massive. People don't understand it. The other thing, lads, as well, is the fixture issue. For me, we are very, very fortunate here in Down. I was working at senior level in Down for 11 years with senior clubs in Down. 6 years with Ballyhoolan in Division 1 and Down, and three with Inraik and one with Mayo Bridge. And to be honest with you, I love Down football. And the reason I love it is because the leagues run, lads, from like April right through to September. Every team plays on a Friday night, 20 league games, no breaks. Sorry, there's a two-week break in July so that everybody can go and watch the parades on the 12th. But the bottom line is, lads, there is 20 games. There's 20 games in Down played consecutively over 20 Friday nights in a row. And that's the bottom line. And the reality is there's clubs in Tyrone, there's clubs in Derry that are going 10, 12 weeks without a single club fixture. Lads, that is wrong.
This is absolutely ludicrous. And the fact that the inter-county, the life and soul of Gaelic games is club football, and it should... I completely
absolutely
agree with Stephen, the fact that, you know, what do they do in Kilkenny? They hurl, you know, the counties. And I remember actually talking to a Carlow man about this, the situation in Leinster where the club game was just absolutely decimated. The fact, if players get injured, grand, but they're better off playing for their clubs. I think the problem, the elephant in the room, is obviously the professionalism, the veneer of amateurism that is basically a professional inter-county game now, and the colossal cost that I think that imposes on club football is horrendous.
Well, if you look at it, lads, now, for example, I just take my own county here and Down, for example, right? There's 40 senior clubs, okay? So if you take an average of a panel of 20 players, that's 800 players, okay? That's 800 players. Say just for talk's sake, 25 and take 1,000. 30 of that 1,000 will play inter-county football, 3%. So 3% of Gaelic footballers out of 1,000 people in Down will play inter-county football, okay? The others shouldn't suffer. They shouldn't suffer. You know, it's, as you say, it's the lifeblood of the association. It's the core of the association. Turlock is very outspoken about it as well. And listen, it's a major issue. Like, there's clubs in Carlow, for example, will play 6 or 7 league games from March to the middle of April. And because it's a dual county, they might only play 3 more games from May to August. Like, that's unheard of, lads, you know. And like, there's counties, for example, that have been knocked out of the championship in June and in May, and they're still playing their county league and championship in October and November. I can't work it out. You know, I can't work it out. And I know it is difficult to try and balance all the fixtures and juggle all the fixtures, but it's a major, major issue. And yet we're calling for more games at the inter-county scene. You know what I mean? So how, if we can't manage the calendar the way it is, I think there was one year in particular that Donegal, I'd done a bit of research on it, Donegal had trained something like 79 times under Jim McGuinness and had played one game, you know, one championship game in like 12 weeks or something. Like, it's unheard of. Martin Clark made a great point to me one day. Martin says to me, he says, I loved Australian rules football, he says, because you could watch the best players every week for maybe 18, 19 consecutive weeks. You know, why don't we rebrand the leagues, play the leagues, lads, at a better time of the year? Like, for example, this year, Down's first 3 games in the National League this year are away to Tipperary, home to Derry, and away to Cork. That first game is the last weekend in January, the first weekend in February, and the second weekend in February. Now, if Down don't get, say, 4 points out of 6, their season is over. And that's the bottom line. Their season is over because their priority is to get out of Division 3. It has to be to get out of Division 3. So your season is actually judged in the mud and the gutters of January and the start of February. You know, and they're going to be training then for the next 6 months for what? For what? To try and reach a Super 8, that's probably unrealistically it's out of reach for them, you know. So, and they could very, very easily find themselves in a tier 2 where 5 or 6 players say, I'm not playing in that. I'm away to America, I'm away to London, whatever it happens to be. And you wouldn't blame young lads at 23, 24 for doing that. You wouldn't.
Yeah, so it's a fairly dark vista if you don't get out of Division 3. But the teams you've named there, some of their good sides. Somebody's going to be playing Tier 2 football who would consider themselves a Tier 1 county, and it'll be very interesting to see what the impact is on that playing squad. Stevie, you mentioned that you're back involved with your own county. You're part of James McCartan's backroom team for the under-17s, is that right?
Yeah, back involved. Met James over the summer. It had no impact, actually. He knew at that stage I was going back to Carlow. It had no impact on my decision, ironically. But the minors are sort of based in Newry here, in the training Newry. It's only like, I think it's about 90 seconds from the house here where we train. So it's not too bad, you know, in that respect. There's no travelling involved. And, you know, as I said, James got a brilliant backroom team there, himself and Daniel McCartan, his brother, and Mark Poland, you know, who's coaching officer within the county as well. Mark's a brilliant coach. And, you know, he just asked me to come in and sort of give a hand in that. So, look, it's great, and it's brilliant to be back involved. Of course, you know, yourselves, lads, the heartstrings, you know, home is where the heart is, like, you know, and it's I'm closer to the Moor Mountains than going clear the head then, you know.
Yeah, well, listen, best of luck with the clear head, best of luck with the time spent at home and the under-17s and with the new job as well. Thanks a million for talking to us this morning, Stephen.
Pleasure, lads. Thank you very much, lads. Pleasure.
Stephen Poacher there giving us some thoughts on his decision to step away from Carlow.
Yeah, he mentioned mental health a couple of times there. You could tell that it must be so tough for inter-county managers who, you know, if you're in Carlow, I suppose, what are you hoping for apart from the league? You're hoping for a couple of championship wins?
Yeah, they beat Kildare, you cause a bit of trouble. You know, you give everybody a sense of self. Like, that was a very successful period of time they had by Carlow football standards, and actually by any football standards.
I believe he spoke about Broderick there, and, you know, you get a great kick out of watching these players that you wouldn't really be familiar with from a floating voter of inter-county football or whatever. When you see guys like that lovely left-footed kicks, and you get almost a greater kind of joy out of watching that and the young upstarts than you do from the really good teams. And you know, I remember Turlough going on the late after, I can't remember, was it the Kildare, one of the games that they beat, one of the big games they won, and he clearly had a few pints after the game, but they invited him on last minute to come on to the Sunday game, and he came up and he's just brought so much joy.
The Sunday game.
So Gabo was on my mind, obviously, but he came up on the Sunday game, and he'd obviously been enjoying himself and just brought so much joy to such a stilted system right now. That and I know, like, what he said about the Dublin players, like any Dublin player I've met, they're great lads, but
yeah, and actually this time of year they're really good in the media.
Yeah,
I would say
they weren't in the All-Stars though. I mean,
I didn't know that.
Ask anyone who was at the All-Stars, there wasn't really anything out of them. And this is, I mean, it's a bit of a joke at this stage, I think, because I think Gaelic games needs to be promoted. I think you can't be snaffling the players at this stage.
Yeah. All right, 29 minutes past 8 this morning here on OTBAM. We're talking football next. I can hear from Mick McCarthy. Here he is talking about Troy Parrott.
Of course I'll speak to him, yeah. Like I speak to all the players. But I'm sure he's thrilled to be in the squad. Well, he did. He had a smile from ear to ear when he came in last night. And he'll be looking forward to it.
He seems to be the type of player so far with Tottenham and with the 21s here that, you know, he's been very, very confident in all of the teams and games he's played in. Do you expect the same from him when you see him to train this weekend and if he does play on Thursday?
Let me see him train today. I've seen him walking. I've had a bite to eat with him. I can't really judge anything on sitting down and having an evening meal and lunch with him. And I haven't seen him since, really, to chat to. Don't forget we've got 27 players in as well. Let me judge him better when I see him in his first training session that he'll have here on the pitch today. It's hard to judge him before on that. I can't.
Yeah, so Mick McCarthy can't judge Troy Parrott from the evidence of the games that he's played so far until he actually sees him in training.
I've said this before, I find that quite strange, but you know, Mick knows football better than me, and he obviously likes to see players in training, and Troy is still a work in progress. He's very young. But the New Zealand game is going to be, for an Ireland-New Zealand football game, is going to be reasonably exciting in terms of some of the players you might potentially see.
Yeah.
Unlike Aaron Connolly, unfortunately. But I'm hugely excited by Troy Parrott, and hoping to see the likes of Jack Byrne get plenty of game time as well.
I've got 4 tickets to give away for Ireland against New Zealand. It's on this Thursday, kick-off 7:45. These are decent seats, row AA, so that means you'll be down kind of pitch level, I think, doesn't it?
I'm in the AA. Yeah.
And
that's pitch level, yeah.
So we just need you to share
wherever you're watching this with us this morning, and make sure you're following whatever social account, and we'll put you in the draw and we'll give them away after our debate with Phil a little bit later on.
It's some friendly games are like, you know, you wouldn't, you, if you were Paige, you wouldn't go. But this isn't one of them. It's at the, on the 4 days before one of the biggest games you've had in years. And I think the shackles will be off in the New Zealand game. You know, they will try to play, and you'll get to see Troy Parrott, which I think you can say, well, I saw his debut game or whatever.
So. Hopefully, yeah. Is he definitely going to play?
I think he'll play Parrott anyway.
Yeah, Parrott.
Well, like, what's the point?
Start him. Start Jack Byrne. Put them in. Let's see.
I would agree, but I guess who's he going to play? I mean, who's he going to play on Monday? I don't know. I would start Jack Byrne, and I would probably start Troy Parrott as well. Just let's see. We're going to have this debate with Phil, but let's almost just gamble on playing football for 90 minutes and see how it works out. Give us some hope for the future.
Yeah, you kind of need to practice that, don't you?
You do.
I mean, you do. I wonder how different things are now than they were under Martin O'Neill. So, in the last game, did we make a significant change in how we, our defensive alignment?
No, not really. But in fairness, Mick had no time in this job to, like, how could Mick, in fairness to him,
exactly, every single training session you would expect then would be down to the second. We're going to do this for this bit. We're going to do this for this bit. We're going to do this for this bit, because that's it. That's how we want the team to play, right? Wouldn't you?
Yeah, but if when he came
up and happening, and then the stories are coming out of training camp, is that like everything has been perfectly practiced? We know exactly what we're doing. Like, Conor Horan played half a game at left back. There was never any intention of him playing left back, right? Why did he do that? It's a waste of 45 minutes of international football for somebody.
I don't know. His antipathy towards the likes of
if you've got no
Ryan
time
Manning
in the job, don't waste the time.
Yeah, fair enough. But, you know, in terms of could he change the way we play drastically in the space of, you know, there's always that notion, should we give up one campaign in terms of the future? Mick didn't have that choice.
No, and I don't think we should ever give up a campaign.
Neither do I, especially when we'll be playing in Dublin next summer.
Absolutely,
but,
not this campaign, yeah.
But I would tend to agree the New Zealand game, why not try things, you know?
Missing Aaron Connolly is a bit of a disaster.
Ah, yeah. You know, I thought he was a bit unfairly criticised after the Switzerland game, because he was a little bit of a fish out of water in that, you know, he was playing with players he wasn't really familiar with. He was kind of playing in a dysfunctional team, really. The midfield was completely dysfunctional with a guy up front who wasn't really used to that position and isn't quite good enough for it. And I thought he showed plenty of spark. I wouldn't have given up on him at all. And it would have been great to see him at the very least play on... with Parrott on Thursday. Interesting, Stephen Kenny was at the awards the other night, and he seems to be absolutely buzzing for life at the moment. So if you're to glean anything from his general demeanour on Saturday night, he's very excited about the job he has ahead.
Yeah, well, so he should be.
I would be. I think the 21s are a great generation of players.
Yeah, now, it's unfortunate that they're being forced to fly halfway around the world to get to their next qualifier and all that stuff.
Well,
the money wasn't found, or a deal couldn't have been done with a supplier somewhere along the way to get them there.
Well, to me, that's bad, but we are in a situation now where there are serious financial problems, obviously, in the FAI, but the Daniel McDonald's story, I thought, on Saturday raised far bigger questions. Like, the ethics of you know, some disparity between what sort of money was going to the disabled footballers, which the FAI has been seemingly unable or unwilling to actually answer. I don't think that there's been enough made of that. It raises so many question marks.
Okay.
We had the Sunday Times, obviously, then the story on Sunday that they're going to bring a legal challenge to cover their costs from the Delaney stuff, but that Daniel McDonald story definitely needs further analysis.
All right, we'll come back to it definitely for sure. It's the Sporting News with Tom Malone next here on OTB AM. First, let's hear from Mark Lawrenson talking on last night's Off the Ball about Pep Guardiola.
I think this is the kind of first glaring mistake that Pep Guardiola has made, because, you know, he, as you rightly say, he's had the whole summer. Maguire, obviously, who's, you know, a very good player. He's not a top player, but you're not telling me he couldn't have improved what they've got at the back at the moment. Otamendi has always been a player that's made many, many mistakes. John Stones has never really kicked on. We knew about his footballing ability at Everton. He looked very, very good. The problem is when push comes to shove, he makes terrible defensive decisions. And you know, to sit in the office every day in the summer or wherever he was, Guardiola, and say, no, we're not going to buy a centre-back, not going to buy a centre-back. If you are a fabulously wealthy team, you just go and buy one. Whatever. Even if he just comes into the squad and kicks the two or a plane or three, whichever way you play, if he kicks them on, because they turn around and think, wow, he's come to play in my position, and then you improve your own performances. So it's just a really, really strange one.
Yeah, that's Mark Lawrenson speaking on Off the Ball, the football show last night. You can subscribe to the Football Show podcast on the Go Loud app, or indeed wherever it is you get your podcasts. Tom is here. Tom, how are you?
Hey, Jerry, well.
What's going on?
Well, looking forward to International Week.
Did you have a winner at the weekend? Did you back a winner and are you now 10 and not out? Because Tom had a winner first. He was like, oh, one to watch. First one up. Yeah, abracadabras. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it was very good, wasn't it?
Very impressive. Having, yeah.
No, my nap, which was the most napped horse in the Irish field, came second to another JP McManus runner.
Oh, was that in the handicap hurdle? No.
Yeah, Rock the Bone?
Yeah.
In Nace, yeah.
Or Nace, yeah.
And I was supposed to have a horse running yesterday, and Ferry House was called off, so it hasn't been a great few days.
There you go.
Let's start with Mick McCarthy. He's praised the form of defender Kieran Clark, who's been resurgent for Newcastle United in the Premier League of late. With Richard Keogh injured, Clark is in the frame to feature behind Shane Duffy and John Egan in the national team setup. McCarthy says Clark's a good option to have ahead of the must-win Euro 2020 qualifier against Denmark in Dublin next Monday.
Yeah, I went to watch him at West Ham. He played very well. I thought Newcastle were brilliant, to be quite honest. Scored a couple of goals. He's not somebody that I need to watch. And like, he's not like a new player that I've just suddenly found. I've known Kieran. He was in my first squad, but he's been injured. It's just the fact that he's back playing. Newcastle have had good results, and maybe that's a bit part down to him as well, because he played very well.
Well, Aaron Connolly will miss the visit of the Danes and Thursday's friendly against New Zealand due to a groin problem. The Republic of Ireland women's team are two wins from two so far in qualification for the Euro 2021 campaign. They're away to Greece this afternoon. That game gets underway at 1 o'clock Irish time. A win for Vera Pez's side will send them 6 points clear of Greece in Group I. It's a first away game in the campaign, and defender Deanne Caldwell told FAI TV she has no concerns about the travelling.
No, I don't think so. Personally, I really like away games. Obviously, we'll miss the home crowd because it was absolutely fantastic against Ukraine. But no, I think it's always exciting to play away from home as well. It's another challenge for us and one that we're really looking forward to.
Well, Raheem Sterling, and it seems that was reminiscent from Dream Team or something, wasn't it? But will play no part in England's Euro...
Dream Team?
Yeah, Harchester United.
God, remember when they played Shells in Talca Park, and I think it was the same day as Bowes Rovers, which was a 6-4 game in the Morton Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
And like, there were far more people at the Dream Team. I remember this is one of the most depressing indictments of where Irish football is at ever.
I mean,
I went out to see Fletch and
yeah,
whoever those other characters were. Are you trying to defend them? Or?
I mean, come on, it's like, you can't be giving out people like entertainment.
Yeah.
It was 6-4 in Tala, what, or in Morton Stadium, what do you want?
It's like in Morton Stadium, not exactly a renowned football ground, really.
No,
an athletic track around it.
Horrible place to watch football. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the same day. I think Talca, there was like 10,000 out of
the opportunity to appear on TV, right?
Yeah,
totally. I mean, come on, it's like,
what
what's going
appear
to win?
On TV?
I presume was it not filmed?
Yeah, but like, they weren't.
Crowd scenes.
Yeah.
That they're going to cut and use again and again and again. You could be on TV for the rest of your life.
It's another of my big annoyances about sport, where they do these crowd scenes like at a key moment in the game, and they cut to a girl and her friend in the crowd, and just to see if they get a reaction. And you're just like, why? What is the relevance of this? I want to see what's going on in the pitch.
The
Gaelic
TV
games
directors
are particularly bad for it. There'd be a great score and they go straight to the crowd, and I'm like, show the bloody score a couple of times.
The replay. I want to see the replay.
I want to see the replay
from a different angle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Raheem Sterling will play no part in England's Euro 2020 qualifier against Montenegro at Wembley.
You're
on
angry
Thursday.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've got to be angry for a 9:05.
No, okay. Next week you can come in and do your.
I'm in Phil and 9:05. I want to be angry as well.
Okay. Anyway, the City forward is axed by boss Gareth Southgate for squaring up to Liverpool's Joe Gomez on the first day of England duty yesterday. The pair, of course, clashed at Anfield on Sunday as well, and tensions boiled over with Sterling at fault. He's gone onto his Instagram page since to hold his hands up after apologising to Gomez and the rest of the squad.
Squaring up's a bit hard. I mean, they're different size squares if you want to. I mean, it's not really squared up. There's a huge difference in
skirmish.
He grabbed him by the throat, apparently, at training. After. So the altercation, we don't know exactly what happened. So we're filling in the speculation on the basis of rumour and innuendo. But apparently, Sterling grabs him by the throat.
Yeah, it sounded like.
He's very, very brave.
You can't be at that.
Yeah, you can't be at that. Liverpool boss Jurgen Klopp, meanwhile, is confident VAR will get better with time. Klopp and Guardiola were among the big names to attend a UEFA coaches forum in Switzerland yesterday, where the controversial video assistant referee system was up for discussion. And of course, came in for criticism in the win on Sunday in the Premier League. Klopp admits VAR will never be perfect.
It can be improved, and at the end, it's 100% that everyone knows that. A lot of things are still done by human beings, and we are all not perfect, so there are still, there's still a space for some mistakes. But of course, it's only about improving it, and nobody asks for perfection in that department. Just you want to have the right decision, that's all.
And a huge blow for the Tyrone senior footballers. They'll be without their captain, Matty Donnelly, for 6 months, potentially more. The Trillic clubman sustained an injury in a recent Ulster club quarter-final clash with Derry Gonley at Brewster Park that they actually eventually lost on penalties. But he's to undergo surgery on a tendon injury, which will see him sidelined for the entire National League campaign and potentially a doubt for the Ulster Championship opener with Donegal as well in Balbuffet. And a huge blow for them. And finally, Racing Affair goes ahead today, Johnny, 5-2.
Despite your tweet of the grounds in a nearby field yesterday.
Yeah, it's so like, bad right now.
That's how bad social media is. I mean, Fairy House can't go ahead if this nearby field is anything to go by. With Tom having a photo of what appeared to be a muddy field. But it was, of course. What happened? Racing went ahead.
Racing went ahead.
Right, and your horse hasn't run, that car
didn't go ahead
cancelled.
Yesterday.
I don't know what's going to happen. I think he may run on Thursday in Clonmel, but yesterday's race was
made for him.
Horrible. And, right. I was coming down from the Wicklow, what's the road to Wicklow? The one you know, the N11?
N11 or the N11.
So there's a load of roadworks on it for the foreseeable, I think. So it was a really slow road. But I didn't know whether it was, like, the time that Google was giving us to get back to Dublin was like, it was literally a kilometre a minute, and it was so slow. I was wondering, is this because of the N11 roadworks, or is it that the road looked like, like, literally, it was flooded, like, all over. By the time we got to Dublin, there were floods, and I was like, Fairy House is going to be in jeopardy tomorrow.
Well, it's a contrast, because this time last year, we were talking about global warming and how we're never going to get soft ground ever again.
And they're calling off Fairy House twice in sort of early November.
Yeah, climate change is real, though, Tom.
It is real.
But it's great, though, because it does mean that, you know, we won't have to use our heaters as much in winter, and there are positives, as Leo would say, to climate change.
8:43 a.m. this morning, you're watching OTB AM. If you missed anything, don't worry, you can listen back on our podcast all straight after the show. You can get it wherever you get your podcast. The best place is obviously offthewall.com/podcast, or you can search for OTB AM in the Go Loud app. It's also on Spotify, where the podcast is timestamped as well, so you'll be able to click through to whatever you want in the two-hour show each morning. Daniel Harris is with us next. He was creative producer on Busby, a new documentary feature film on the legendary Manchester United manager. That's next.
Before Matt Busby, there were no football managers.
I was born in a small mining village. The people were brought up in a faith which was football. I had no experience as a manager. All I had were certain ideas, faith in those ideas, and faith in the club.
Matt was the first tracksuit manager training with the players. This was revolutionary.
He had this aura about him. He made everybody feel important. The Busby Babes, the way they played, was rock and roll.
Busby was trying to build the best club in the world.
When you look back, do you think that there was any part of it that caused a sacrifice that wasn't worth it?
Oh, yes.
I woke up and I was in my seat, but I was about 30 yards from the plane.
As the details seeped out, the magnitude of the horror became apparent.
It hurts to think about it.
My first reaction was never to have anything to do with football again. I had the feeling that I might have been responsible. I was terrified to come and look at the ground and feel the people.
My wife said the lads that have died would want you to carry on. And I got this obsession again.
I still want Manchester United to be the best team in Europe. And the only way they can be the best team in Europe is by winning the European Cup.
Mark showed the ability to knit a team, and it was an absolutely brilliant team.
It was Matt's last chance to win the European Cup.
He was like a father to us.
You wanted to win for him more than anything else.
Well, nothing is more gratifying than to spot a star and see him develop year by year, to his predestined place among the gallery of the immortals.
Daniel Harris, good morning to you.
Hiya.
What was your involvement with this?
I was the creative producer, which could mean any number of things because there was another creative producer and we did very different jobs. But what I did was I did all the interviews that you see in the film and then sat in quite a bit of the edit with the director, Joe, and the editor, Emiliano, just putting the film together, moving bits around, putting bits in and out, that kind of thing.
How did you get involved? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Dan is finally in the movie business.
I've made a couple of other films with this company before. Like I co-directed a film about darts and I was a consultant on Class 92, which 4L 73, the company that made this, also made. And so we kind of were talking, had the idea was kind of germinated and then wrote a proposal for it and ended up, luckily enough, getting to make the film. Quite daunting also, though, because what happens if I balls this up? But well, hopefully we didn't.
Yeah, exactly, because so many of that team are actually no longer with us. And we're just at the outer reaches of being able to make a documentary where there are proper eyewitnesses around who were part of a squad or a team, who saw the team play, who knew what he was like as a man. Like, this is kind of, after this, it's like in a book and it's somebody reading a book about what happened at the time. And that's like the prism of three or four different voices already at that point. So kind of very late in the day, but it's just in time.
Yeah, I mean, what we tried to do is we obviously tried to find stuff that people hadn't seen before, because so much of this stuff has been seen loads of times and it's still great and feels great to enjoy it on the big screen also. But you're trying to look for stuff that people haven't seen before. You're trying to put it together in a way that hasn't been put together before. And obviously there are people who it would be nice to speak to, but you can't because they're not around. So, yeah, there was a sense of in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, it would be impossible to make this film. So it's an amazing story and a story that we felt like needed to be told in this way on the big screen or in a cinematic way. And that's what we tried to do, really, because, I mean, it lends itself very much to cinema because ultimately cinema is about drama, is about love, about identity, all these grand themes, and they're all there in Busby's story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Martin Scorsese is definitely going to look at this and go, this is real cinema, this isn't Marvel, there's nothing cartoonish about any of this. Why did you feel it needed to be made? That's like to go back to where the germ of the idea happens, and certainly there are loads of books that people can read, but it's definitely got to a stage in life now where people don't read books as much as they used to, or certainly fewer people are reading as many books.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, because there are, there's one, Eamon Dunphy's book about Busby in particular, A Strange Kind of Glory, is a brilliant book. But you can do different things with visual media that you can't do with written medium and vice versa. And what we're able to do is we're able to show things and you're able to see the expressions on people's faces as they tell you about these things. And there are just little kinds of inflections. I think it was in the bit that you just played there. There's just one of these bits in the film that always stuck with me when John Aston, who played for United in mid to late 60s, played the European Cup final in 68. So his dad played for Busby's first great team in 1948 and was a Marine prior to that. And so when he grew up in Manchester and when the tragedy happened, when Munich happened, his dad just went down to Old Trafford to see if he could help. And there's just this little inflection where he says, the magnitude of the horror became apparent. Yeah. And he just has that little pause and says, yeah. And then you suddenly, there's just something about it that the way that he delivers the lines, the little boy who remembers this trauma, that you can't capture in words. And what you get in a film is you also get to put together a load of viewpoints. So you get stories that people wouldn't really have thought about. So Ken Ramsden, who worked for United for years and was secretary, also the club secretary, his mum and her sister used to work at Old Trafford washing the kits. And he talks about the fact that one week they're washing kits and the next second they're polishing coffins. And no one was around to say, are you OK, ladies? Because that didn't happen then. And there was no one to be able to do that. And the way that he delivers that story, you wouldn't get that in a book in the way that you get it in a film, because you're actually looking into someone's eyes. Same with Wilf McGinnis, who was injured, so he wasn't on the plane to Munich. And the way that he talks about that, again, you can only capture that either in person or on film, because you're never going to be able to repeat, to quite relate exactly the feeling of seeing him do that. But there are lots of other things that you could do in a book that you get a lot more detail in a book, because a book's a lot longer. You don't have to cherry pick. You can just put everything there. You don't really have to satisfy a dramatic structure in the same way to make it work on screen. But you can get a lot on screen by just getting to see people. I mean, you're seeing into their souls here.
Do you find, Daniel, that you get nostalgic for the old game when you look at, you know, when you look at this movie, and when, you know, you look at the socialism of Bill Shankly and I suppose Brian Clough to an extent as well, and a lot of these old managers came from mining towns like Busby, and, you know, the players in those days were literally, you know, blokes that were on a decent wage or whatever, and it was a completely different time when, you know, I guess there were... It was long before the days of the Premier League and that. Does it make you wonder about what football was in those days? As Busby said, it was sort of the religion of those working class areas.
I think it still is the religion of lots of people. It's interesting history, because it does sort of make you nostalgic for a time you don't actually remember, and for a time that maybe even never existed. So football was very different then. Of course it was. But I mean, one of the things about Busby is he didn't pay his players properly, and he actually, in some cases, obstructed his players getting paid properly. So, on the one hand, the players weren't paid properly, but on the other hand, other people were making money off the backs of the players, and they didn't really resolve that till much after Busby. So, it was a simpler time, I would say, but there's a sequence in the film where Busby talks about bringing in executive boxes, and then you see Busby talking about bringing in Louis Edwards into United, and Louis Edwards got into trouble for selling condemned meat to schools, and his son, Martin, eventually sold United out to the Glazers. So there'll always be things, is what I'm saying. There were definitely things in Busby's era that were better, and Busby was a great man, and Bill Shankly was a great man. But there were other elements that were not so great. So, I mean, if you were kind of picking, trying to build your ideal epoch of history, you wouldn't just go straight back there. You'd have a bit from there, but you'd also have a bit from now, where you see the best players are properly rewarded for being the best at what they do and giving millions of people thrills. That sounded weird, but you know what I mean. Providing us with this amazing entertainment and this amazing joy, the players are properly rewarded. And in Busby's time, you didn't get that.
I wonder, too, how much of the impetus to make the film now comes from your view, and certainly a view that's widely shared, that there's this massive separation between the club ownership and the fans, and the real fans of the club, and that actually a story like this re-centres everybody and reminds them that this is a club that has come through everything that it's come through.
Well, it's like you were talking about religion, and all religions have their foundational myths, and the difference with your football foundational myths is they're by and large true. And so the stuff that you know about Busby, in some ways, it's absolutely ridiculous. What I would say is I've interviewed a lot of people, and I've never interviewed anyone who speaks about one person the way every single person speaks about Matt Busby. And you ask people, what were his bad points? He didn't have any. And you kind of mull that over in your mind. And when you hear it from one person, you think, yeah, all right. But then when you hear it from also extremely hard men who grew up in changing rooms, like if Paddy Creran tells you that someone doesn't have any bad points, you're inclined to believe him, because if someone did have a bad point, Paddy Creran would be the first in the queue to tell them about it, because he's a person who tells people things. And so to see Busby in that way, it's like it kind of almost feels like this guy can't be real, and he's part of that foundational myth, except he is real, because here is all this evidence about it. And I don't know if the film will be able to re-center people exactly, because it's not going to change anyone's reality. And the reality is that United still are where they are. But I think it is nice to remember where you came from, because and it does feel for a lot of people, definitely for me making it, felt like family history, because United and anyone's football team will be in their life from as soon as they can remember until the time that they die. It's the only thing you can be sure of will be a constant. You might, like, you have relationships that you think will continue, but they might not. People might die, You might get married, you might get divorced, you might change your religion. All of these things might change, but the thing that will always remain with you is your football team. And there's nothing else that is quite at that level. And often, not always in football, but often that football team will be passed down generations. So speaking personally, I've found the experience of getting to make the film quite moving and quite terrifying in some ways also, because my dad passed United on to me, and his dad had a season ticket at Old Trafford in the 40s and 50s. I never met his dad, so I guess United would probably be the only, Old Trafford would be the only place in the world that we both frequented. And it's very powerful, that sense of heritage that permeates and percolates a life from the beginning until the end. And that's how these foundational myths work, how these stories work. And so it is definitely a very powerful thing, and film is obviously a very powerful medium. So hopefully the two of them fit together quite nicely, and people watch the film, and not just people who support United, because it is a story not just about Manchester United, but it's a story about football, it's a story about tragedy, it's a story about redemption, it's a story about love, it's a story about the power of one man to do amazing things. And hopefully people see the film and feel some things, because that's ultimately what you're going for.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker, as a writer, you're trying to make people feel things.
Yeah, no, totally. I want to play another clip. It's here's some Bobby Charlton. Have a look.
All the players used to say, until you actually play in the first division, you don't realise how much you push yourself through pain barriers, which you never do in reserve team games.
Bobby would say, I'm knackered, I'm tired. And my father would say, well, you're not going to die. Get running again.
My right ankle was swollen up, and it was quite painful. And I hadn't played in the reserves for a few weeks. And he called me up to his room and said, I'm playing you in the first team tomorrow. If it was one time I didn't really want to play, it was that day. But I said, he said, are you all right? Is your foot all right? And I said, yeah, it's all right.
And suddenly the attention of the whole country was on Manchester United, because they're playing babies, you know, they can't possibly win anything.
Pleasant game, played in the sun, played in the rain, and the team that gets me excited, Manchester United.
Manchester United. A bunch of bouncing Busby babes, they deserve to be knighted.
Wow, I've never heard that song before, that's class.
I want to hear it again.
Yeah.
Look, the Busby babes, how, like, was it... Does it come across how unusual it was to put so much faith in young players at that time, which to me, it just seems extraordinary looking back?
Eamon Dunphy talked about this in quite a lot of detail, about how it was revolutionary and the babes were basically rock and roll. And they knew exactly who they were. They were very kind of defined characters, and no one had ever seen anything like that before. And Busby knew that if you could get these young players in, then you'd be able to meld them into what you wanted them to be, and they'd be loyal to you. And I think for the people in Manchester, they saw young kids who were just like them, who were having a great time and also producing this brilliant football on a weekly basis. And they were a long way ahead of the other team. I mean, as it happens, had the crash not happened, the league was quite tight in that season in 57-58. They'd won the league by miles the 2 years previously. So the league was quite tight thereafter. But yeah, there was nothing like them before. There'd never been anything like them before. And it was a long time till we saw anything like them again.
Can I ask you about the modern team and how things are going at the moment, yeah. Daniel, just to wrap this up?
Yeah, you must.
Things have improved a little bit. I mean, the last time you were on, they were just coming off the back of defeat. But I made the point at that stage that with a young team like this, there will be these blips. So long as the trend is your friend, then everybody can at least have a little bit of buy-in. And it seems to me that Solskjaer's got things trending the right direction. And there will be blips along the way, but that the team are playing better football. There is an identity growing. There are relationships growing on the field. Some of the young players who are coming in are playing well. Things are vastly improved, I would say, than they were from the end of the Mourinho era and even the middle of the Mourinho era.
Yeah, I think that's right. United have some good players. They're not a good team yet. But I think the game against Brighton was good, similarly to the game against Norwich, because what you saw was a routine disposal of a team that United should always beat pretty much every time. And they've been making hard work of basically every point that they've won this season has been a struggle until this point. So it's nice to see them actually playing some good football, looking like they're enjoying themselves. and the kind of game that you had been expecting from Brighton would be a much harder game than what it turned out to be because of the way that United play, but they seem to be finding ways to break teams down. And I guess now that he's more or less settled on a first 11 and a formation, you're seeing players growing in confidence. So even the players who, I mean, they're not of the quality that United have come to expect, like Fred, say. He's had a run of games, so now he's got some confidence and he's playing. You're seeing a much better version of Fred than you were seeing before, even if the best version of Fred isn't even the best version of Michael Carrick, never mind the best version of Roy Keane or Brian Robson. And what you're also seeing is you're seeing some of the younger players grow with playing more games. I mean, Brandon Williams has shown, there's nothing that we've seen from Brandon Williams that suggests he isn't ready to take Ashley Young's place. He's done well pretty much every game he's played, and now it's very hard for Solskjaer to drop him. And when those kind of things happen, it improves the atmosphere, I'm sure, in the team, around the team, and in the ground. So I think that the game against Bournemouth that United lost was disappointing because of the manner of it. United started quite well, didn't score early on, and then became discouraged very quickly, and quite quickly went from okay to not all okay. But if you look at the general picture of the last 6 weeks or whatever it is, it's actually United are starting to play quite well. And they definitely have the attackers to hurt any team if they can find a way of playing through midfield to get them the ball. And that seems to be improving.
It's one thing, though, about the Manchester United fans I found, Ger, that, and I don't know, you know this better, Daniel. Throughout the three or four managers that they've had, obviously, since Fergie, so what's that, four managers. The fans have been incredibly patient and they've been very, very slow or reluctant to get after the manager, which would not happen at other clubs, particularly around the continent, but also in England where they, you know, a club so accustomed to success that became pretty crap very quickly and was underperforming. The fans just, and I know it's a little bit different with Ole, but they seem to have this kind of strange patience and understanding that this thing needs time. And I find it quite interesting in that regard.
I think that it depends on the circumstance. Like it seems to me like you've seen with Moyes, Van Gaal and Mourinho is that the fans turned when the hope ran out. So gets to a point where you look at what's going on and you realise that it is never going to happen under this manager. What you want to happen is not going to happen. And at that point, more or less, the manager's position became untenable. So Van Gaal actually, his position became untenable about 4 months before he actually ended up going. But more or less the others, that was when they got fired. Once it became clear that there was nothing they were going to be able to do. And the thing with Solskjaer is people are patient because he's him. And also because he's a young manager and he needs to learn. And anyone sensible understands the constraints that he's operating under financially. So I think that there are a lot of people that think he was the wrong person in the first place. And there are plenty of people probably that think he's the wrong person based on what we've seen so far. But there are also a lot of other people who can see that things are going in the right direction. He's brought in some good players. He's got rid of players who may have been good, but who you would be unlikely to win the Premier League with. And as long as people can see that there's a plan and they don't run out of hope, then it doesn't really make any sense not to back the manager in the ground because you want the team to do well. And also, let's say United fired Solskjaer tomorrow. Who would they then go and get who you know will definitely succeed? And no one really knows the answer to that question because succeeding in any football manager's job is extremely difficult. Maybe the best two managers in the world currently manage Liverpool and Manchester City, so you're not getting them. And then if you fired Solskjaer, who would you go and get? And so people really want Solskjaer to succeed. And so people are happy to give him the opportunity to do what he needs in the same way that they gave other people who they felt no emotional attachment to time to see if they could do it, because everyone knows that it took Alex Ferguson a long time to get there and the game is different now and Alex Ferguson had done amazing things with Aberdeen, but you can't, it's pointless saying, well, it's definitely not going to work because of what I've seen in the last 3 months, because that's not how life works. And like, it'd be very simple and very simplistic to think that a dodgy start to this season tells you that Solskjaer is not good enough.
So if he doesn't make the Champions League, though, like, is that what he has to do? So I'm looking at the table here. They've got 16 points. Man City have 25. Man City are fourth. So 9 points off fourth at the moment. It's a big gap. Not impossible. But the way Leicester and Chelsea are playing at the moment, you know, you wouldn't expect them to drop too many points. It's only 9 points head start from
a quarter of the season gone or a third of the season gone at this stage. What would be acceptable now for the rest of the season for Solskjaer?
I think that if United don't make the top four, they won't fire him if you can see that there's signs of progress and if things are going in the right direction. So if United go on a good run from now till the end of the season, but Chelsea and Leicester don't drop, then you wouldn't fire him for that. Whereas if they end up finishing 12th and it's rubbish, then you would obviously have to think about firing him very seriously, because United shouldn't, however many injuries United have, they shouldn't be finishing in that position. And the reason why they are where they are is mainly, I think, because they drop points. Obviously, they drop points where they were, those games where they were leading. And if they just hung on, they lost the lead to Southampton when Southampton had 10 men. They lost the lead to Liverpool. They lost the lead to Arsenal. They lost the lead to Wolves when Wolves basically played well in the match for 5 minutes and scored during them. So it's easy to look at United and say that they're rubbish, and it's true to say that they are. But if you actually look at the games that they've played in, there have been enough games, I think, that we've seen so far this season where you can see some signs of progress and feel that on a different day, they might have actually got the points in those games. And that won't be good enough in 6 months' time, because you need to have seen improvement from August to May. But if you do see that improvement between August and May, then I think it would be fine to give Solskjaer another season and some more money to buy some more players to see what happens.
Yeah.
Because it's as I said before, the previous managers have been fired when the hope has expired. And whether or not the hope has expired won't necessarily be contingent on league position, because if United win their last 10 games, let's say, but it's not enough, then you would say, OK, something's happening.
OK. Is the movie Busby getting a cinema release in Ireland?
It's not getting a cinema release anywhere for reasons with which I'm not familiar, it not being my department. It is available on DVD and Blu-ray and all these other names of things from November the 15th.
November the 15th. All right, well, best of luck with it and congratulations on it too.
Cheers, lads. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care. That's Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts on the new movie Busby, which is available in 3 days' time. And
we need to see it in the cinema.
Yeah, it'd be good. We should...
DVD and Blu-ray, is that even a thing anymore?
Yeah, I presume it's also streaming places.
Yeah, yeah. But it is great to watch like a football film or documentary in the cinema. It's quite a lovely experience.
Maybe we could try and get a screening together. That might be something for us to work on.
Absolutely.
Right, it is 9:08 this morning. We're going to be back talking Irish football in a few moments.
OTB AM.
Well, my view is it's ruining it at the minute. It's ruining the spectacle. My son was at the Tottenham game on Saturday. He said, "Dad," he said, "they're in 4 minutes and they all start booing." And yeah, it's the most ridiculous decision I've seen. Anyway, we used to complain about referees, and now we complain about somebody that we can't see. I suppose so that's anonymous for them. That's okay. But I always. So TC and I would always watch the games back on a Monday morning, despite the fact we might have been having a bleat and a whinge about the referees. Monday morning, 95%, I would say, of decisions they got right. There might be a throw-in, there might be a... And then there'd be an odd one where it's a real blatant one and we'd be moaning. And then the following week, there'd be a blatant one in our favour that we might be... And then there wouldn't be one for 2 or 3 months. And at the end of the season, it probably equaled itself out. And despite all this technology, I'm still not sure that they get the decisions right. So I preferred it before, I must be honest.
I'm sorry, Tony, but I'm angry as well. I was angry before the game. I've been angry for a long time.
He didn't hold his fire there, Roddy. What do you reckon?
I think he was a bit angry.
Well, if it lives up to the sting, we're grand. I'm angry, Tony. That was one of the great League of Ireland moments. Are you actually angry, though?
I'm not angry yet. But I have a feeling I'm going to be angry maybe next Monday night, Tuesday morning.
Why?
If we don't beat Denmark. But I'm going to hear people say, oh, you know, what did you expect?
What do you expect?
We're crap. Like, we should, like, you know, we don't have the players.
We don't have the players, Phil. What do you expect?
We don't have the players, which is just the biggest load of nonsense. We have 11 players. Are you telling me we don't have 11 players that qualify to play for Ireland that can't come up with a game plan where they can pass the ball from A to B and create chances? Unfortunately, in the last few years, the last couple of managers have basically told us how bad we are. Trapattoni got the ball rolling when he said, you know, you're not very good. This is a team, by the way, that had Damien Duff and Robbie Keane in it, and Richard Dunn, John O'Shea, Shea Given. Just a few players off the top of my head. We better throw in Keith Andrews to keep him happy as well. And
Kilbane
as well.
Although he saw Kilbane out.
So, you know, telling us that we don't have a good team and basically saying this is how you're going to play, because if you try and play in any other way, you're not going to succeed.
Before the Italy game, we were in a press conference in, I don't know where it was. Would it have been Sopot? It was wherever. Where was the Italy game? So we went up anyway. He's the Italian journalists are asking Trapattoni questions and they're loving it because he's like giving long, informed answers,
yeah,
playing to them. And then at one stage, he looks over at us, the Irish hacks on one side of the room, you know, a bit pasty-faced, a bit pale.
Less attractive than the Italian
journalists. Well, you know, they still live at home, so they spend all their money on fashion. What are we supposed to do? We're like saddled with Irish mortgages. And Trapattoni looks over at us and kind of gestures and goes, "Non è campione," to the Italians, pointing at us, going, "They're not champions." I mean, because I'm pidgin Italian.
Was he on about the team or the journalists?
I mean, he was on about the Irish generally. So the expectations, they want me to play football. I mean, come on, you've seen the chumps I'm working with, was the inference. Non è campione. And he looks at us. And the Italians all turn around and look at us. And we're like, okay, he might be right.
They were laughing.
I mean, he might be right. Well, he showed a mirror up to his ear and he might be right. What are we going to do?
We showed them and Lille, didn't we?
We did.
We showed them and Lille. Yeah. And that is the narrative, unfortunately, that kind of runs with Irish football, where we're told we
prove
don't
me
have
wrong
the
though. Trapattoni says, "Prove me wrong."
Yeah, but how can you prove him wrong if he doesn't pick players? Like, Wes Hoolan was a player he never picked because he didn't fit into a system. He wanted to play a 4-4-2 system.
He wouldn't play Coleman then either.
Yeah, he didn't pick Coleman in a squad. Not only would he not play him for Euro 2012, he didn't pick him. He didn't play Seamus Coleman. It's not as if Seamus Coleman was just new on the scene.
He'd had the season at Blackpool, had he?
No, he was already playing for Everton and he was doing quite well. He's one of the longest serving Irish players in the Premier League at the moment, Seamus Coleman. But
the book stops at the FAI though. I mean,
yeah, because unfortunately
they
appointed managers.
I think if we bring this all back to like 25 years ago, these guys didn't invest in school. There's enough players right now playing in the Premier League.
I'm not talking about that. The FAI, and in particular,
there's enough players who are good to play football. If we cannot let the managers off the hook here.
But what I'm saying is the FAI, and in particular JD, appointed managers that, you know, effectively they knew what they were going to get. They took a gamble on Staunton that spectacularly backfired. Trapattoni, Martin O'Neill, they weren't going to be getting like these coaches that were going to suddenly, if you wanted
short-termism
to get us qualified for a tournament with
Martin O'Neill got out of a group in the European Championships.
He did, but stop about that. We beat Italy when Italy were not even trying.
We still got out of the group.
It doesn't matter. We were poor.
We were 1-0 up against France.
No, we drew 1-1 against Sweden. That's what we achieved in that tournament. Forget about the Italy game. Italy didn't give a damn about
that game. We gave France a
game. We did. We weren't bad. Red card.
Ran out of steam against France.
Yeah, ran out of steam.
It was but scorcher. That
Martin
day.
O'Neill doesn't have a philosophy on how we should play football. He's a man manager. So he brought
him
in.
He does. It's just not.
Players should know their roles.
He doesn't have. There are young coaches in Ireland now, we'll say at the underage level and the League of Ireland, who have their own ideas. They're bringing in ideas, which mainly involves not telling the players that they're crap. It involves what Stephen Kenny does say. Don't talk about your limitations. Talk about what I believe you can do.
But Mick McCarthy is our current manager, right? Who did play some football, as you said earlier on, in his first period with Ireland. But the narrative has been seeping out a little bit from the camp. He doesn't have the players.
The MO Mick was given was get us to the Euros. We've got games here, Mick. We need to be there. So
I agree with that in some respects, right?
The approach then will be, okay, let's play low-risk football. We can't take risks because we have to get to the Euros. And that's what we've done. We've scored 6 goals. We've beaten Gibraltar twice, we beat Georgia, and we've drawn 3 other games. And we come away from games.
We did, though. That game away, we did. Yeah. I mean, an unbelievable save by Randolph at 0-0.
Yeah, and the fallout from that was, well, it was Mick's first qualifier.
It was windy.
It was Mick's first qualifier, so he hasn't had time to prepare the team. And then we draw 0-0 with Georgia, and we're told Georgia are amazing. Okay, they drew nil with Denmark, but Denmark reacted by beating Switzerland.
Do you know what annoys me though? And
I do kind of blame the narrative of the prevailing discourse of fans. That game in Cardiff when we beat them to get to the Denmark game. I couldn't get over that night in Cardiff, the celebrations of people. That was horrible, horrible football to watch. And we should not be celebrating playing like that. At any level, I would have much preferred us losing 3-2 that night.
Can't give out fans for celebrating the team
winning. No, but they celebrated. They're involved in celebrating something that was anti-football. And then when we beat Georgia 1-0 at home.
The players are supposed to know. Like, the players are supposed to understand that we fluked this.
You
can't have a go at the supporters for celebrating.
You absolutely can't. You can't celebrate. Stephen Kenny wouldn't go to watch Jack Charlton's team.
What are they meant to do when McLean scores? Just sit in
like,
their hands.
No, celebrate, but at least after the game say grand. But like, let's not get over the top here. We played horrifically bad football. When we played Georgia and we beat them 1-0, like, I was saying after the game, like, this is still pretty bad. We had 2 shots on target that night. We beat Georgia, who can't score 1-0 at home. And people were really, really positive about that. And I'm like, if we're positive that we're beating Georgia 1-0 at home, not really playing any football, we are at a low ebb here.
The heroin free kick goal, the tennis ball's nice.
That we 2 shots on target.
Yeah, I thought you were pretty terrible in that. People now tell me that, oh, we played well in that game.
We had two shots on target at home to Georgia.
No, but I think the encouragement for a long time that night was that we seemed to play with a plan where... Mm. You know, it wasn't a case of go out there and just...
Get the jersey half an hour before kickoff.
Yeah, and do... Like, it seemed that we played with a plan, but unfortunately...
Can I ask just about the jersey before kickoff half an hour plan? How did we play in our last game? Did we not go 3 at the back?
We were poor, yeah.
At the back. And then Stephen said after the game, we didn't work on it in training.
Mm. So I'm sorry, what's the difference between this and Martin O'Neill? And why are all of the ex-footballers not out killing Mick McCarthy for doing what Martin O'Neill did?
Mick's probably a bit nicer to them, in fairness, than Martin O'Neill. But if we do get battered by Denmark, there's very little difference.
There's no difference.
Very little.
We didn't work on it.
We play slightly better football.
Set
pieces are a lot better. A lot better at set pieces, defending and
yeah, we've done a bit of work on set pieces.
Yeah, we're a bit more organised.
We've done any work on the team shape.
We're a bit more organised under Mick. You can certainly
see
that.
Are we though?
I think, like, the set pieces is a crucial thing because all
that's our only way of scoring.
But I think back to even under in O'Neill's first campaign, the goal that Sean Maloney scored in Glasgow, that came off a short corner. We kept getting done as short corners. We got done against Austria
Denmark
with a short corner. We got done
2-1-1 in a corner in Denmark.
Christensen's goal. Yeah. So we always got done with short corners because it just seemed that lads didn't know what their roles were.
But are we better than this? Are we better? Do we have the players to play better than
Absolutely.
We did? We'll say in the second half in Geneva, when we kind of played a bit, but basically Xhaka ran the game in both games. Are we better than that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we're obsessed with how many players we have playing in the Premier League. Premier League players that qualify to play for Ireland shouldn't be a necessity or a guaranteed starter in our team, because there's lads that play in the Championship that would be more suited to international football. Like, I mentioned Wes Hoolihan. I don't want to go down the whole, like, you know, there'd be tears coming down my eyes because I miss Wes. But people used to say to me, oh, if he's so good, why is he playing for Norwich in the Championship?
I don't care
how he plays for Norwich in the Championship. But when he played for Ireland, he wanted the ball and he wanted the players around him to get on the ball. And we don't have players like that now. We have players that have the ability to do it, but there's no message to say, do you know what, you're not demanding the ball, and if you don't demand the ball,
you're not my team.
Get out of my team.
I don't know who's calling the shots there, because Mick, you could see in Tbilisi, he was imploring the players. But if you ever watch an Ireland game from behind the goal, it's really, really informative, because the outlets that the defenders have, the midfielders are running away from the ball. And I don't know why that is, because they are better than that.
They don't want to give the ball away. If the fullbacks have the ball and they launch it, then the midfielders are pushing up to try and win the second ball.
And
you know what? Sometimes that, I've no problem with that. Liverpool did that against Manchester City the other day. They said, can't get caught from the City press, so let's just play a ball down the channel. We know their back four is a bit shaky. We could force them into a mistake. That's the Premier League leaders doing that. I've no problem.
Okay, that's changing in terms of your opposition as well.
That's also, you know, a team that presses and
collectively and knows exactly what they're doing.
And they tactically press.
Do we do that?
We don't. And
could we do that?
Absolutely. It takes time. But actually, we mentioned the Euro 2016. This was the most prolonged period of the Irish players working with Martin O'Neill. And it coincides with the best football we played under O'Neill. We were actually good against Sweden in that game. We should have won the game.
And it felt like that was the opportunity for it to kickstart on to the next campaign, continue with that style of play. But the first two games after that were like, oh my God.
Because we drew 2-2 away to Serbia. But the narrative coming out of that was, well, Serbia is not an easy play. And by the way, I was at that game. There was 7,000 people in that stadium, which if you saw the stadium last week when Spurs played Red Star, it was packed. It was more intimidating. We played with 7,000 people who didn't give a shit about Serbia because they were at a low ebb. They obviously qualified out of the campaign.
Yeah, we turned them.
But Martin O'Neill kept harping, you know, not many teams are going to beat Serbia. But we were hopeless that night. But the players got their backs up that night because they thought, whoa, we drew with Serbia, so you need to back off. And certain players have come out and said, I think the Irish media have it in for us. No, we're not expecting miracles, but for some reason we've just settled on this is what's acceptable. So we know pretty much what team he's going to pick on Monday. Picks the same team the whole time, and the message that sends to me is, yeah, it wasn't great, but, you know, we'll try it again. And if it doesn't work, we might get a playoff.
We did our, well, we're definitely getting a playoff, right?
Yeah.
See, he said somewhere, I can't even remember where it was now, he said beating Denmark would be the greatest achievement. And you're like, well, all you had to do was win the last game. We wouldn't have to beat Denmark.
Yeah.
And the last game was
Georgia
a winnable game.
The was the killer. Like,
yeah. And that wouldn't have been your greatest achievement. Yeah. That would have been just doing what you're supposed to do.
See, there's no real evidence that we can beat Denmark in terms of how we're playing, in terms of our record against the big teams. We beat Germany. Apart from that, we generally can't beat good teams. This is going back years and years and years. And the only thing I'm thinking of, can we hold on in there at nil all for about 70 minutes? And I don't think, if we went 1-0 up after 10 minutes, I'd still have no confidence whatsoever.
No, because, again, what happens is the default mode is...
defend.
We're Ireland, let's defend. Whereas most other teams would defend to a certain extent, but they'd also have their eye on another goal because obviously the second goal makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, because they'd have worked on counter-attacking in the
week. Patterns of play. I was talking to somebody about this last week, wondering, would the best version of Robbie Keane have a chance in this current team?
Yeah, I mean, the best version of Robbie Keane is like 0-3, 0-4. Robbie Keane could do anything.
No, but he'd struggle in this particular team because he'd be up top on his own. They'd have to change the team around because Robbie wouldn't be suited to the way we play at all at the moment.
He'd be pulling his hair out. Yeah.
Well, like we'd stick McGoldrick's job would be to knock it down to him. So there would be at least we have somebody here who's going to score a lot of goals. We're going to create a lot of chances for him. You need to go. Final word for you, Johnny.
I'm going to the dentist and he's told me it's going to be an hour.
I've been angry for a long time.
I've been angry. This is not going to be good. The final word to me is I just can't wait for Stephen Kenny to get the job, to be honest. I think, in fairness to Kenny, which Mick didn't have, he will have a bit of time to bet in the players through the Nations.
World Cup qualification.
Yeah, but he'll have the Nations League. He'll have a bit more time. And he's had the 21s, many of whom he will introduce.
Really, though?
Right. Absolutely.
That's another problem.
Troy Parr, Connolly, Leo Connor, Malumbi will definitely...
Okay, well, I have the 21 starting 11 that lost to Germany in September 2018.
The under-21s?
The 21 team. Kieran O'Hara got his cap against Bulgaria as a substitute. And Josh Cullen was the captain of the 21s. He obviously played very well against Bulgaria. I'd actually start him against Denmark. I'd like to see him against New Zealand as well. And that's it. That Ryan Manning, there was talk of him getting...
The FAI told us he was going to play this game.
Yeah, so...
And he didn't make the squad, did he?
That's where... like, we've all these talented young players coming through. But the hardest transition is from 21 to senior level.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we might see Troy Parrott on Thursday. Is he going to get any game time at Spurs? We don't know. Aaron Connolly obviously has been called up to the senior squad. Now he's injured. He's getting game time at Brighton. But so many of these players, Connor Masterson had to leave Liverpool to go to QPR, not getting game time. So if these lads don't get game time at their clubs, whether it's Championship, League One, then... they're going to be in the international wilderness for a couple of years. We might see them a few years down the line when they've got more.
What if Stephen Kenny doesn't treat it like that, though? If he says, look, if you're staying fit and you're playing some reserve team football, I know you can do a specific role for me.
I think
he's come through, he's brought that team through the under-21s. Is there a case for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is a case for it. And the lads asked me to pick a team that I'd start against Denmark. And... I included Jack Byrne in the team.
Okay,
and so people are going to say, oh...
this is your team here, is it?
Yeah, people will say, well, why
Darren should... Randolph's and goals.
Yeah.
You've got a back three, Shane Duffy, John Egan and Kieran Clark.
Yeah, but our best players are our wing-backs.
So Matt Doherty and Andy Stevens.
So, when I say wing-backs, we have to use them as wing-backs, not as a five-man defence and they're just stopgaps as well. Like they have to be how we play. Like, again, I refer back to the Premier League leaders. Who are their two most creative players? Their wing-backs.
Yeah.
We have to try and get these wing-backs involved. Obviously, if Seamus Coleman was available, there'd be a debate whether it's Coleman or Matt Doherty. We know that Coleman is going to win that in terms of Mick McCarthy.
Yeah.
But someone like Jack Byrne. Jack Byrne plays in the League of Ireland. And people will say, well, that standard isn't good enough for international football. But why does Jack Byrne play in the League of Ireland? He's good enough to play elsewhere. He's had his issues in terms of being over in England, didn't work out for him. Doesn't mean he's not a good enough player. He might get back there. But he's playing with a smile on his face. Guarantee you if he starts against New Zealand or plays, he'll demand the ball because he's a technical player.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing was when he played well against Bulgaria, Mick McCarthy said after the game, he played well, but how would he do in the cut and thrust of it against a more physical team like Switzerland or Denmark?
Yeah.
So basically we're saying, what I read from that is he's too small. He's too small to play international football, where I think of, who's the greatest player that's ever played the game? Okay, you can argue.
Leo Messi is where you're going, right?
Leo Messi, you could even put in Maradona if you want.
Yeah, but even if you look at Xavi.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's pretty small in a similar role.
Yeah, so it's, I just want players that will actually get on the ball and, you know, one player, two players actually taking responsibility, getting the ball, create space for other players, and then the snowball effect.
That Byrne's bigger than Xavi. I just checked it here. Yeah.
So
1.75, Xavi 1.7. Yeah, Anders Iniesta 1.71.
Yeah, he obviously gives you a set piece threat as well. I've included Howarthen as well because I'm realistic enough.
So here's
as well.
The team. Sorry, we stopped. So you've got Josh Cullen at the base of your midfield.
He's playing well for Charlton. Charlton's form has dipped a little bit in the last few games. I went for
Howarthen, Jack Byrne, Maguire behind McGoldrick.
Yeah, now,
is this because Connolly's injured?
Connolly's injured.
Yeah.
Now,
okay.
There's a few options there. You could maybe put O'Dowda in behind Maguire as well. Robbie Brady is a player that would suit us if we play more possession football. He's obviously trying to get back to form. He's had a tough run in terms of injuries. Callum Robinson has actually been disappointing enough for Sheffield United. I had high hopes for him in the Premier League this season. It's still early days, so you know he can turn it around. He's impressed at times in the Irish team.
Well, but they're all going to be grand for a couple of seasons in the Premier League, it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, say for example now, Darren Randolph plays in the Championship. Has he ever played a bad game for Ireland? I can't remember him ever playing a bad game since he was called to replace Shay Given in that Germany game. He obviously had a part in that goal. That's 4 years ago. He was named in the Championship team of the season last season. They're third from bottom, but I guarantee he'll turn up and he'll produce a performance against Denmark on Monday.
He's getting plenty of practice.
And it kind of goes back to what you're saying, that some players are playing well for the clubs but might not necessarily suit the way we want to play internationally.
Yeah.
And then what happens is we pick players because they're playing in the Premier League and then they come in and they're like, well, how come we can't do it in the international team? Because it's a different game. International football is a different game. Premier League is faster paced. We need players that are comfortable in possession, that can pick a pass. And as I said, I just, my worry is it's going to be more of the same on Monday. And look, who's to say we don't get a result because we put in an unbelievable rear guard performance and we nick a goal in a set piece from a set piece.
Unlikely though.
Unlikely. But if it happens, you know, we celebrate. I don't really buy into Johnny's like given out about the Irish fans celebrating. Yeah, of course they're going to celebrate. Yeah. It's your country. It's your team.
And you spent money to go.
Yeah,
and
absolutely. But I talked to plenty of Irish fans in Cardiff that night who had no problem saying, we weren't very good. We got away with a brilliant result.
Sometimes getting away with things is even better than doing it properly.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Tony, but I'm angry as well. I was angry before the game. I've been angry for a long time.
He didn't hold his fire there, Roddy. What do you reckon?
I think he was a bit angry.
There you go. First new slot in the books. Thanks, Phil.
Thanks.
That is it from us on OTB AM this morning. Thanks for joining us. You can stay tuned to the Off the Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio across the day. If you miss anything from OTB AM this morning, Stephen Poacher talking about leaving Carlo and the general state of the game. The sports pages, Busby, the new documentary with Daniel Harris, one of the creative producers, and our Irish football discussion. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcasts or on the Go Loud app, where you can watch it back on our YouTube channel. Tonight on Off the Ball, the football show and ultra runner Hillary Allen. Tomorrow morning at OTBAM, Nathan is in studio. We're talking to Jan Molby ahead of the Denmark game and Liverpool legend Robbie Fowler about his new book. See you tomorrow at 7:30. Good luck.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.